Okay, we're ready to call the meeting to order. Dr. Prater, we're ready to call the meeting to order. That's right. Thank you. Okay, the board met in closed session to discuss the public employee performance evaluation and a real property discussion. Do we have a consensus on the order of business for this evening? Everyone good? Okay. So the first thing we need to do is, well, welcome everybody. We'll get through some of this pretty quickly and get on to you. The approval of the minutes from the May 5th, 2015 meeting. Any revisions, changes? Okay, then we're ready to approve those. If
I move approval.
And I'll second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Abstentions? Mr. Buckman is abstaining. So we have 6 in favor and 1 abstention. Approval of the minutes from May 12th, 2015.
I'll move approval of the minutes from May 12th.
You just did that then.
I'll second it.
Wasn't it May 12th that you made? Oh, okay. All right. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And Mr. Buckman is abstained?
Yeah.
And, oh, right, okay. And Ms. Eisendreth Rogers. All right, we're on to our student representatives to the board. Who is going first this evening?
All right, good afternoon, board members and public. First, I want to start out saying congratulations to Mr. Jaday and Mr. Coxwell for Teacher of the Year and Volunteer of the Year, respectfully. Just to give you a heads up of what's happening at Morro Bay right now, we have AP tests. I guess they're having it slow, too, which I assume me and John are both very tired from and very, very glad are over. We have our school elections in full swing now compared to just starting when I was here last week, or 2 weeks ago, rather. It'll actually be the first time we're going to have the two candidates actually debate in front of the school, which for some reason has never been done before. In terms of sports, we actually have a swim established a school record while they're at CIF in Riverside this past weekend. And then two students recently signed on to attend Division I sports at UCSB. I heard they got a pretty decent scholarship for that too, luckily for them. Students are excited about end of the year. We have an end of the year dance to celebrate this. It's actually going to be the first dance too where we have it completely student run, which means, of course, ASB sets it up. But instead of a DJ that we bring in from the outside, we're actually going to have a student DJ voted on by the students to go and provide us with music. Very excited for it, myself personally, but the student body is also. Also, we have our seniors, of course, getting ready, like as in Slow High. We're going to take our outing to Ravine, and then our grad night at Six Flags. And on a point of the agenda, I have to say for the concurrent enrollment with Cuesta, I must speak very highly of this. I'm actually a student who just came from a Cuesta final himself. I speak very highly for it. I think it benefited myself very well, and I'm glad to see it developing further with the district itself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Jono.
I just want to say first that I proposed a Ravine senior picnic, and I got shot down. So can I go to your school? Because that sounds awesome. It's a little late.
We'll sneak in.
So I was told to make it much better today by Mr. Questenberry, who I ran into, told me that my meeting discussions were subpar, so I thought I would bring it up a notch. Really. So today we had our senior recognition rally, which was awesome. We had pennants hanging from all over the gym of every college that every senior was going to. They all sat in these chairs in the middle of the gym, and we had the eighth graders from Laguna come over and visiting. We also did the Teacher of the Year, the Francis M. Warren Scholarship Foundation, where our four finalists, Mr. Greg Ross, Mr. John Franklin, and Ms. Kate Stevens and Mr. Ryan Ritchie were all the top four and voted on by the students. It ended up being Mr. Franklin winning with a big confetti thing, and it was awesome. There were tears. Maybe it was just me who was crying, but there were tears. After that, we had our ASB students leading the eighth graders all around the campus, showing them what it's going to be like next year, answering some questions, getting them signed up for sports, and it was an awesome all-around blast. And tomorrow, we have the Golden Tigers, which I would like to invite all of the board to come to. 6:45 tomorrow, there is free cheesecake. It is delicious, and if you don't like cheesecake, you're wrong. And this, we celebrate all of our esteemed students for everything that they've done in the classroom, and we also have some scholarships by the Black and Gold Foundation. And then on Friday, we have our yearbook distribution. That will be coming on Thursday and Friday. And after that, we have 24-hour relay, which will drain every single student of their energy. So by the time they come to school on Tuesday, they'll only be slightly functioning. But it'll be awesome. It's good. And then we have prom coming up the weekend after that, which we have invited the students of Morro Bay who were unable to make it to their prom due to the incident with the car. We believe that they should have the opportunity to go to prom. Everybody should. So we're extending that invitation. Whether or not they choose to accept it, it's up to them, but we thought we should let them know. So I brought a video along with me today of the Teacher of the Year nomination. It's all the students saying things about the teacher who showed it to them. Maybe that was where I cried. I don't know. It all gets so blurry. But here it is.
Don't even talk. If you can't make it to this dinner, don't even talk to me. You're stuck.
Stevens is a fantastic teacher because she taught me European history and made it fun and enjoyable and hopefully helped me pass the AP test.
Miss Stevens is the most amazing teacher ever. I'm not even kidding, she's given us home. Theater is our home. She's given us personality as students. And I just want to say, we love you, Miss Stevens.
Okay, so I love Miss Stevens so much. She's a beautiful, nice teacher, and I feel completely myself around her. Like, I'll go into the classroom, and, like, it's just my friends, and I'll be the weirdest person I can. She helps me so much and has helped so many people's lives.
I like Mr. Ross because he's super personable, and he's not tied down by the constraints of suits and ties, and he's really happy to work with kids.
Mr. Ross's voice is like chocolate to my ears.
Mr. Ross is the best track coach.
There's something to say about Mr. Ross. I would probably say that he's my spirit animal. I love Mr. Ross.
I love Mr. Ritchie because he taught my astronomy class and it was killer.
I love Mr. Ritchie because he didn't make chemistry as horrible as it actually is, and his Wheel of Misfortune was my favorite part of the day.
Mr. Ritchie is like the second father I've never had. His beard makes me so happy. He's a great science teacher, and I promise to give you back your pay.
So Mr. Ritchie wasn't only a teacher to me, he was a mentor, and he not only taught, like, it's a guy that I could just, like, honestly, like, speak to him about anything, and I still do. And he helps me through a lot of stuff. That's why I appreciate Mr. Ritchie.
Mr. Franklin made me look forward to history every day.
Mr. Franklin is an awesome teacher. He makes you really excited about history, and it's just, he's an awesome person.
Under Mr. Franklin's tutelage, I feel nothing short of hashtag blessed.
I love Mr. Franklin so much, I came to class after the AP test.
Mr. Franklin's a really awesome guy. He taught me a lot of A-push. I wasn't really interested in history, and then all of a sudden in his class I started loving it. He made my days exciting.
I might add that Mr. Ross, one of the four finalists, this is his first year teaching at Slo High, and if that doesn't give you any indication of how awesome a guy he is, you know, that I don't know what will. So thank you, everybody, for letting us come and tell you about what's going on campus.
Well, thank you, Jono, very much, and the video was great. I don't even know all those teachers, and I thought I was going to cry, so, you know, Mr. Quisenberry.
I think I cried when I came on. If I had to pinpoint it now, that was it.
Now, this is the official public record, Jono, and I just want to tell you how much I've enjoyed your
presentations about San Luis High, no matter what I say about you while you're on campus.
Thank you. Now, are you both done with AP exams?
Yes.
Well, there's no reason for you not to stay for the duration of the meeting, then.
Yeah, I did hear there was cake, and also the guy who kind of controls two of my class's grades is here winning an award.
Oh,
so
yeah, be careful.
If I leave, that might not look so
You're
good.
Welcome to stay as long as you wish. Both of you know if you...
How long do I have to stay to get cake?
Not too much longer. Not too much longer.
All right.
Now, while I do love cake, and I am very sad that I miss it, I actually, even though AP tests are over, I have Cuesta finals now to worry for. So genetics and astronomy, here I come. So okay. I want to thank the board again.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. We are ready to just talk about our volunteers.
Well, it is an exciting night, as you can see behind me. We have some fantastic people to be recognizing. And the first group that we are going to be recognizing are our Volunteers of the Year. And I would love it if Carrie Shattuck, Gary Nichols, David Jansen, and Tom Coxwell could come up here. I'm going to say a little bit about each one of them. So David Jansen is the epitome of knowledgeable, passionate for students and thorough. As a computer science professor and a parent, he has served on several committees related to information communications and technologies. He's donated countless hours of his time to set an innovative direction related to computer science at Morro Bay High School. And he serves an advisory role as the Career Tech electives and aims to stay connected to post-secondary schools and the industry. And for that, we recognize David Jansen. We have certificates? Okay. Next, I would like to recognize Gary Nichols, volunteers in the IS&T department 3 days a week, believe it or not. He is instrumental in preparing devices for students and staff in a timely fashion. He comes in early each and every day. He has a great attitude. He has a wealth of knowledge and a willingness to help or lead any project that is needed for San Luis Coastal. So thank you, Gary. Next, we have Carrie Shattuck. Carrie, her principal has written this about her. There are volunteers and then there are super volunteers like Carrie Shattuck. Carrie's been a volunteer at Monarch Grove for 7 years and a 2-time winner of the Monarch Grove Parent Teachers Association Service Award. She served as PTA president, vice president, secretary, and school site council member. She chaired a walkathon, which brought in $20,000, and organized fifth grade science camp fundraising, which was $25,000. Pretty impressive. Helps with school-wide events and is pretty much a celebrity on campus. She is passionate about education and freely gives her time and energy with passion, humor, and love. So thank you, Carrie. And out of all these fabulous volunteers that we received, we chose Tom Coxwell as our District Volunteer of the Year Award. And Tom Coxwell is Morro Bay High School's Volunteer of the Year. He is an active member of every booster club. He is a volunteer coach for both girls and boys tennis. He is a vice president of athletics boosters. He's a member of the music boosters, co-founder of the Bands on the Run. He attends and contributes to the monthly superintendent meetings with the district PTAs. He's a positive voice in the community representing Morro Bay High School, and he chooses to focus on the positive and was a key factor in garnering support for Measure D and securing a positive future for Morro Bay High School. So I think it's a photo op time, yes? Are we looking to get a photo? Luana is our official photographer back here, and I think she's here to take a photo. Dr. Prater, do you want to?
Do it after, or you want to do it now?
You want to do it during break?
Yeah, let's do it during
cake time.
Yeah, during cake time.
Okay. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Thank you so much, each of you.
Next, we have our Teachers of the Year. And at this point in time, I would like to call up Roy Aguirre, Amy Burris, Cindy Dixon, Jim Johnson, Nancy Thorne, and Mark Townsend, and Daniel Jude. And before I do so, is Andy Marinello here? He had said he was coming tonight. No. He's going to speak after cake? Okay, beautiful. So I will start with Daniel. Daniel from Morro Bay High School. Daniel has been a special day class teacher at Morro Bay High School for 3 years. He has a passion for bringing out the best in his students. This year, his students were involved in Skills USA, Special Olympics, on an on-campus vocational program called Pirate Plaza, and countless other activities that require time outside of his regular job duties, including Project Surf Camp. Daniel is an exceptional educator who truly cares about the success of his students and brings out the best in everyone. Thank you, Daniel. Roy Aguirre is not here tonight, but he was chosen for C.L. Smith. I'm just going to read a small bit about him. Beyond the extras that Roy does, there is a simple fact that Mr. Aguirre is a gentle, kind, and compassionate teacher who calmly gets his students to move along the learning continuum despite the challenges and hardships they all face, both in the classroom and beyond. It's no wonder that his students lovingly come back to visit years later. Who wouldn't want to spend just a little bit more time in the safe and comforting space of Mr. Aguirre's room? Deanie Greenelsch was recognized from Sinsheimer, and she's not able to be here tonight, but I'd like to read a little bit about Deanie. Deanie is the type of teacher every parent would want for their child. The qualities that set her apart are the strong sense of compassion she has and deep commitment to her students' success. Additionally, she regularly offers valuable feedback to colleagues and administration about ways to improve our organization and is willing to be part of the solution. Thank you to Deanie. Next, I would like to recognize Mark Townsend from Laguna. Mark designs his lessons to engage his students at higher levels of thinking and so that they can work cooperatively. Parents appreciate the ease of communication with Mr. Townsend and having access online to what their children are doing daily in his class. Mark is a member of the Laguna Middle School Management Team. Whenever Mark speaks, he is poised and articulate. Mark is one of two teachers at Laguna who has piloted the Chromebooks this year. Lastly, Mark inspires students and coworkers to push beyond their comfort zones to seek out new ways to learn and to teach. He makes learning in his class fun and exciting as well as challenging. Thank you, Mark. Next, I would like to recognize Nancy Thorne. Nancy is the poster child for exemplifying mastery of the California Common Core standards. Her growth mindset mantra has students truly believing they can do anything if they work hard enough. Not only does she teach rigor, she practices it. Nancy has served on the school site council, leadership team, PTA, piloted new curriculums, and won the respect of all who have the opportunity to work with her. She helps to guide new teachers. She participates in Arbor Day, partners up with our local Target store to promote more reading and writing in the schools, participates in the annual Altaresa Club golf tournament. So she's very active in the community. And what makes her special is that in Nancy Thorne's life, teaching is her number one priority. She gives her all to education every day by her constant, pleasing interaction with her students, preparing lessons and grading papers late into the evening, and instilling the love of learning in her students. She is compassionate, hardworking, and always has a positive attitude with all who have the pleasure of coming into contact with her. If you're fortunate enough to know her and call her your friend, you are truly blessed by this fantastic person that has spent her whole life going above and beyond for others. Next, Jim Johnson from San Luis High. Jim is a diligent teacher who is keenly interested in the success of his students. He works hard to align the curriculum with student learning in his advanced placement government classes. He strives to understand the material at such a depth so that he can create coherent, relevant, and entertaining lessons. He is constantly searching for new and innovative strategies to engage students in the learning process. He works in collaboration with his department colleagues, volunteers his time to mentor and guide other staff. Jim is more than a classroom teacher. He is also our student activities director on campus. In most schools, this position is a person's sole responsibility, but on the San Luis Obispo High School campus, Jim combines this immense responsibility with his daily teaching duties. In the field of activities, Jim has few equals. Through Jim's work, the student culture and vibe on campus has changed dramatically over the past 3 years. He created a culture where student government, where students understand that they are there to serve their classmates and the community at large. Jim's passion, dedication, and impact is felt throughout our campus. He connects with students. He holds them accountable to be responsible stewards of our culture and models what a great teacher and educator should be, namely an advocate of young people. Thank you. Next, we have Cindy Dixon from Baywood Elementary. Cindy is a dedicated, caring educator. She is experienced, hardworking, compassionate, and collaborative, and possesses a natural drive to be of support and service to our students and families. Her primary focus is to meet the needs of each individual, seeing them as a whole person. She sees equity as a moral imperative and works tirelessly to ensure that the playing field is leveled and that each child gets what they need to be successful, whether the child is an English language learner, has a learning disability, behaviorally challenged, or is an accelerated learner. Cindy masterfully plans learning activities that allow each student to make progress and to feel proud of their work. She is a pro at reaching those hard-to-reach students. Cindy has worked at San Luis Coastal for 9 years. She is a Title I intervention teacher. She has earned her respect and admiration of all those who are fortunate enough to be touched by her work. She has started at Baywood an annual staff fundraiser with PTA funds matching for Baywood families in need. This year, she is coordinating with Cal Poly to have 40 reading tutors and 20 English language tutors work with the students as one-on-one Cal Poly buddies. She is coordinating with LOMS to have student tutors come to Baywood campus and provide homework support. Cindy Dixon is a powerhouse driven to ensure every child achieves social, emotional, and academic success. Cindy has the uncommon ability to make every one of her students and teaching colleagues to feel welcome, appreciated, and special in a truly exceptional way. So it's hard to believe that out of this incredible field that we have so many wonderful teachers, but we truly do in San Luis Coastal. So this decision, as you can imagine, was a very difficult one for the team to choose our District Teacher of the Year, but the committee has chosen Amy Burris as our District Teacher of the Year. Mrs. Burris is a well-rounded and experienced teacher. With the creation of the innovative sixth grade STEAM program, Mrs. Burris has taken a leadership role in redefining a math and science classroom. Mrs. Burris has developed and implemented a multi-tiered approach to a differentiated classroom. Learning is individualized and content is made relevant to each student while incorporating the outside world to make learning authentic. Through diverse student-driven choices, learners have an opportunity to collaborate with each other, as well as with experts in their field. There are no limits to students' imagination and creativity. And Mrs. Burris has developed a rigorous framework for a student-centered classroom where she has the role of learning facilitator. Mrs. Burris has garnered the respect and admiration of parents, pupils, and coworkers by showing that great teaching is leadership. She rallies team members around an ambitious vision of success. She plans purposefully and executes effectively to make sure students reach that vision. Through intricate differentiation, each student gains the satisfaction of attaining their individualized learning goals. Mrs. Burris leads and develops an innovative model in collaboration with her sixth grade coworkers. She's always reflecting and refining her process, sharing and receiving ideas, and making her class a better place. She has presented at local universities for community organizations and shared her inspiration for making a difference in the lives of students at all levels. She willingly shares her ideas and is a powerhouse in researching and implementing new innovations in her classroom. By taking the time to put information together and articulating her knowledge, she can share that contagious enthusiasm for math and science. As she builds that inner resilience in students, parents, and students embrace the educational model that she is facilitating. The match of student strategies and technology with students' needs has become a hallmark of her classroom. Through purposeful redefinition of her classroom, through the use of 21st century technology tools, she is able to actively monitor student understanding and progress towards mastery of math concepts and fill in missing building blocks from previous years. The beauty of this rigorous classroom is that all learning is differentiated. Each student has a choice to meet the standards or move significantly deeper based on their ability and their pace. Mrs. Burris challenges Generation Z learners in four categories: ways of thinking, ways of working, tools for working, and skills for living in the world. Mrs. Burris insists on excellence in her classroom. And we're going to take photos afterwards, right? Okay, photos, so don't go anywhere. And last but not least, we have our employees of the year. So I would like to recognize the following four individuals. And if they could come up here, I would appreciate it. Carlos Martinon, Jamie Fazio, Diane Dubois, and Dan Block. So I'm going to start by talking about Carlos. Carlos was very funny the other day because as I went around and gave flowers and plants to folks, his supervisor, Annie, had asked him to come into the office because the personnel director was there to see him. And I got there a little late because I was over doing it, giving flowers, I think, to Dan Block's site. And so I got there a little late, and he was shaking by the time I got there. I felt so terrible that that's what they would think of when the personnel director's coming. Really, it's not that bad. But Carlos has been an encouraging presence to the students on his route. Carlos is a bus driver, as you probably know. He is bilingual, so he greets his children on the way to Pacheco in both English and Spanish, which they love. He knows everyone's name, and the kids are excited to see him and excited about going to school in the morning. When he drives older students, athletics, etc., he is courteous, respectful, professional, and friendly. And this was written by Adam Bash at San Luis High. So thank you, Carlos. Carlos also told me that there have been others that have been great role models for him when he was growing up, and so he now believes it's his job to be a good role model for others. Next, we have Jamie Fazio, student database technician. Jamie Fazio is amazing. Not only does she take initiative to accomplish tasks, but she is thoughtful, thorough, and detailed. The quality of her work is incredible. With the support of Kim and Cindy, her work with CalPADS earned our district recognition from the CalPADS management system. Jamie has a unique set of skills, and the way she goes about her work gains respect from everyone that works with her. She is a model employee. Okay. Next, we have Diane Dubois, Baywood Elementary School Secretary. Diane is a school secretary extraordinaire. Diane makes the office a friendly place. Diane makes the work look fun, and while always busy, she never appears too busy to help or greet students, parents, teachers, support staff, or community members. While no day in the school office is the same on any given day, as we all know, Diane can be found doing a little bit of everything. On one recent day, her principal, Jennifer Dinelli, observed Diane to start her day at 7:30, greeting two early arriving students, moving straight into a morning meeting with her principal, getting substitute teachers set up, moving paraeducators to get positions filled, and then at 8 o'clock rolled around, she started on her list for the day, which included managing budget accounts, placing a supply order for teachers, preparing an agenda for a school site council meeting, printing school plan achievement data reports, distributing flyers for a community event, helping children with scraped knees, setting up teacher evaluation meetings, putting the last minute details on the organizing a staff event. While critical, this daily work is not what sets Diane apart. What makes Diane shine is that while all of this is happening, not only does she make it look easy, but when a parent volunteer walks up needing help, she turns as if all she has is time for him and helps to get the Chromebooks ready for their after-school STEM enrichment. That, in essence, is the magic of Diane Dubois. And last but not least, we have Dan Block, Administrator of the Year. The Wall Street Journal defines the difference between leaders and managers in the following way. A manager's job is to plan, organize, and coordinate, while the leader's job is to inspire and motivate. At Bishop's Peak Elementary School, we are lucky enough to have an administrator who does both. Simply put, Dan Block is a fantastic administrator. He stands apart for his ability to foster quality relationships with students and parents while creating a safe, supportive, trust-centered community for his staff. During a recent student study team meeting, Dan's knowledge of our students as individuals was particularly impressive. These meetings can be very overwhelming for parents. Knowing this, Dan connected with the parents and assured them that he knows their child as a whole person. He described this child's spectacular performance during a recent game of handball at recess, shared an anecdote about the student's focus during a recent classroom observation. His attention to our entire student body can also be seen outside of student study teams. He knows every one of our 434 students by name. If we need to find Dan during recess, we have the best chance of finding him on the playground throwing footballs, playing basketball, or debating Giants versus Dodgers with our 5th and 6th graders. He definitely has a heart for his students. One teacher even observed Dan kneeling by a kindergartner to help her tie her shoe. During instruction, Dan can often be found in our classrooms. He has established himself as part of the learning community by frequently coming into classrooms and participating in lessons with students. This helps students to feel that Mr. Block is on their team, which makes him all the more effective. And last but not least, Dan Block is an administrator, educator, and leader of the highest caliber. He genuinely cares about students, families, and the Bishop's Peak community. He inspires us to be the best teachers that we can be and supports us in our growth, in the words of his teacher. It is without doubt that Dan Block deserves to be recognized for his excellence. And now I think it's cake time. Right. Is that okay, Jono?
You want to be first in line?
Yeah.
Thank you and congratulations to everybody. Enjoy some cake.
They wanted to do it after cake. Are you doing the other announcement after cake? So,
everyone's gonna leave.
We have. Board, we have one more. We were going to do it after cake, but we think it would be better to do it before the cake. Before the cake. So we have one more that we would like to do. Is Andy here?
All right, just sit tight. It's going to be fine. Okay, Jono, you can do this.
We had one other nominee for Teacher of the Year that we would like to recognize, and that is Mr. John Geiselbrecht. John passed away this year, as I know many of you know. There was a beautiful memorial for him this weekend. I had the pleasure of spending about an hour speaking to John about 6 months ago, and he was really, truly an exceptional educator. And he, as you know, he taught at Laguna, and he was also at Hawthorne, I believe, but then he ended his career at Pack Beach. And Andy would like to stand up and say a little bit about John.
Thanks, you guys. I'll do my best to get through this. John was a terrific teacher. He had a sense of humor that brought kids into his room every day with a smile. When it was time for John to level somebody in a nice way, because he didn't have a mean bone in his body. He did. But the students that got the discipline from John glowed as it was happening. And they glowed immediately afterwards because he had decided to turn his attention to them. Because he was that special a guy, and he was that special to each one of his students. John touched thousands of kids at Laguna. And then he moved to Hawthorne for, I want to say, 3 years, but knew a good thing, moved back to Laguna, and knew a great thing, and he moved to Pack Beach, where he wrapped things up. In the brief period of time he was there, he made an impact. On his very first day, I had something prepared, but it's never mind. On his very first day, the alpha girl walks into the classroom and she wants to yak. And John said something about quieting down, and she said she was quiet. John said, "Well, I must be wrong, because I thought I heard your voice and I thought I saw you talking because your lips were moving. Or maybe you're just fibbing to me." And with that just black and white, dry, he owned that kid, who became the alpha in John's corner every day. Every day that he was there, she was checking in on how he was doing. John was a guy that, I'm very privileged to call a real good buddy. But I know, I know I'm not the only one. I know there are a lot of people who would say that. He's going to be missed by a lot of the people he touched. One of the things he said as he made a speech for the Gastric Cancer Foundation in December was something along the lines of, if I know that I've touched someone, then my life has been meaningful. Guy touched everybody. He was the best. I'm joined by his wife, Stacy, and his mom and dad-in-law. They're here as well. But there you go. I got some flowers real quick.
Cake.
To reconvene.
CSBA president in waiting.
You have to. I'll help you.
Chris Unger, report to the dais.
All right. We are moving on to item 6.01, correspondence. The board received correspondence from Judy Neuhauser and from Heidi Harmon. And now it's time for public comment. If there's anyone here who would like to address the board for an item not on the agenda, or if you would like to, you could wait for the agenda item, or if you don't wish to do that, you can address us now. I see that Mrs. Roger has some names. She will call to the podium. You will have 3 minutes in which to make your public comment. Mrs. Roger.
Okay, I have Selena Lindahl, followed by Jennifer Schavitz.
Hello. I apologize if I don't do this right. This is my first time. Can I go? All right, Selena Lindahl. I am a graduate of San Luis High, as was my mother. I have a senior graduating this year and a freshman who, the senior is a soccer player, the freshman throws shot put and discus for the track team. I'm here in support of the track and field improvements. I teach economics at Cal Poly for the last 20 years. One of our key lessons is resources should
can and should be used towards the things that bring the highest benefit to cost ratio. And I think we all agree that supporting students in all the different facets of development is money well spent. It's very difficult to actually calculate the benefits. My freshman, as a first-year thrower, has really come into herself. My son, who's graduating and playing soccer, going on to play in college, has come into himself on the track field. So two of my three children have really benefited from the track, which looks not too different from when I came to school here. So I just want to stand in support, in firm support of the benefits to our students, the benefits to the larger community coming up. Raising my kids, spent a lot of time there as well, and I know a lot of moms use it for, a lot of people use the track in general. So I'm also aware that improvements are a tricky thing to budget for. Improvements are a long-term thing to budget for, and in behavioral economics, we always say that humans are just, let's face it, not, it's difficult to plan for things that haven't been done before. So I would stand here and advocate, if possible, to hire, to visit with consultants and to really get, to do due diligence and spend as much time as possible to get this once-in-a-lifetime track done right, in support of all the students now and forever. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Shavitz. Glad to see that the room has cleared out. It's a lot less intimidating now. I'm here in support of the improvements for the track and field at Slo High School as well. I want to encourage the board to consider all the benefits of the track for the community and the students at Slo High School. I have recently initiated the Slowtown Track Club, a youth track club for our county youth, and have had tremendous encouragement from the community as a whole for this type of thing. There's a lot of interest in track and field, and there's not a lot being offered right now. So we're having great success at that, and it's be nice for those youth to see a really nice facility to go up to strive for, to get to at the high school. And as a club president, I have trouble getting training facilities. Cal Poly and Cuesta are ridiculously expensive, and it's hard to train for track and field without a track. So we struggle with that, and it would be wonderful to have a facility right in our own backyard to access. And also, I would love to see the all-comers meets move to San Luis Obispo in addition to what they're currently doing in Tascadero. I don't know if any of you are aware of those meets, but they're a fantastic community event run all through the every July in the summer up at Atascadero High School. And they get hundreds of youth from age 5 to age 90 competing in track and field, and it's a fantastic event. So I'd love to bring that down here to San Luis Obispo. And as far as the students are concerned, running on a dirt track is kind of comparable to playing tennis on a clay court and competing on a hard court. I don't know if any of you are tennis players, but I was. Clay is completely a different surface than a hard court, and when you train on one and play on the other, it's extremely difficult. Our student athletes have to go to an all-weather track to get proper training for their events. It's particularly difficult for the sprinters, the hurdlers, the relay teams. There's no relay markers. Their steps are off on a dirt track. So it's really presenting a difficulty for them, and it's really, really looking forward to the time when they don't have those problems where they can train efficiently on their own home turf. And I'd like to also encourage you to consider the fact that this is track and field, and getting the all-weather track is fantastic, and I that certainly seems that that's going to happen, but I certainly hope that we consider the field events as well, the high jump, the pole vault, the long jump. My son is a decathlete, so he does everything, and he has he struggled with the field events here. And it will be nice to see in the future that our Slo High athletes won't have to do that. They'll have the really good facilities to train on here. And then we can bring our league meets here and our county meets here instead of always going to Atascadero and Cuesta. So really encouraging that. And okay. My time's up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? I don't have any other requests to speak. Is there anyone who didn't fill out a request but would like to address the board in public comment?
Okay. All right, thank you. We are on to superintendent's updates. First in line is business and budget.
Yeah, so the governor came out with a May revise last Thursday, so a lot of interesting dynamics. I'm actually going to be attending with Julie Lang this Thursday, going down to hear the school services presentation. But some key things that I'll just point out for the board, and we'll echo these a little bit in our public hearing for the budget. For education in general in the state of California, it was a great day. So a lot, this positive economy, a lot of money going into the economy because of Prop 98 meant that a lot of those funds went to schools. And so it's particularly those schools that benefit from the LCFF, the local control funding formula. While we're a basic aid school district, it doesn't really assist us. A lot of those schools that are LCFF definitely are going to benefit from this influx of funds. And so in particular, there's the target where districts are supposed to be funded at, and then there's the level that they're currently at. And each year they've been making kind of gap closures to get closer. So this year they have closed that gap by 53%. So it's very substantial for a lot of schools and a lot of districts. So again, because we're a basic aid school district, it doesn't help our bottom line, our budget, in terms of revenues, but it's hard for us to fault, I think, all the other districts in terms of for them to come up and to receive more funds. So it's a good thing. Some positive things that could happen for us, in particular, one, the paying off of the mandated costs and one-time funds for the district. So initially, the governor had set out a $180 per student amount to pay back on top of our mandated block grants. That was back in January. With this latest round on Thursday, it looks like that is raised up to $580 per student. So roughly an extra $3 million in one-time funds for the district. I had Julie go back and contact the state and see what our overall mandated costs. And so we're actually owed about $10.4 million. So this will take that down. But again, any money, I think, for the district as we move forward, it's great. And for us to actually receive some of those mandated cost funds are important. Again, one time. Great, helps us with our bottom line, helps us get through kind of some difficult times right now with raises and STIRS and PERS and so on, but still a positive for us. There's a couple of bills going through right now with adult education, in particular, where we may be, because we have maintained our adult education program, that we may be in line to receive some funds. So we'll see how that kind of pans out. So that's a great thing, potentially. There's also some money that the governor has put forward to increase CTE grants. And so we have our current grant, I think, with Cuesta College and moving forward. And so it'll be interesting to see if there's more money available or if there's other grants and things that we can apply for in that round. There was nothing in this budget so far that talks about getting rid of the reserve cap. And so that was one of the things that, we'll continue to look at. We're actually going to have to, at our next board meeting, have a separate item about our reserves and why we, have a higher than a 3% reserve, which is fine. It was interesting, I think, in terms of, as well, with all of this money going to school districts and this great day, there was very little about STIRS and PERS and about the impact that that's having on districts long term. And I think maybe the fact that districts are getting so much money that it was kind of their way to not have to address that concern this year. So we'll see how that unfolds over, as well as when the budget's adopted. And then lastly, when they did do kind of a SF squared, did a kind of a call that afternoon at 4:30, and I listened to them. And there is some legislation going through, and I've talked about this before with the board, that there's a disagreement between the Department of Finance and Department of Ed of whether or not we'll continue to receive our categorical funds that were, kind of set at the 13 level, which is about $3.2 million for the district each year, that if we reach the target amount, do we continue to receive those or not? So there is legislation going through right now, and it looks like, fingers crossed, that they are going to clarify that, and hopefully that'll be something that will become more set in stone with this that we will continue to receive those funds, and it won't be a, you know, up to the Department of Finance or Department of Ed to decide how that's going to be go through. So that's a positive thing for us, and we will address that with the 7-year budget when we talk about the budget tonight. So those are just kind of some of the key features from the May revise.
Is there anyone from the public here to talk about this? All right, Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Mr. Pinkerton, it occurs to me that at my very first board meeting many years ago, I was listening and I made a note to myself, STRS, ? And the board member seated next to me wrote down State Teachers Retirement System. Just for the benefit of anyone from the public who may be watching our broadcast on this, could you just explain what STRS and PERS are? Because we've done a lot of talking about increases in STRS and PERS, and I don't know that we've really defined what those are for the public.
Okay. Yeah, it would be good, and it'll tie right into our budget as well. So our certificated staff, for the most part, is part of the State Teachers Retirement System. Our classified staff is part of PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System. And so for an employee, the district pays a portion of the employee's retirement benefits, the employee pays a portion, and then the state pays a portion. So what they did at last year is, in order, because the both PERS and STRS were having funding issues long term, they needed to find a way for to pay that debt and to ensure that those monies were available for employees in the future. So what they did was they increased the employee contribution a little bit, a couple percent over the 2-year period, and then they basically doubled the employer percentage. So where it was 8%, it rises all the way up to close to 20% over the next 5 years. And so you'll see really really clearly when I present the 7-year budget, and you can see that $700,000 increment added each year more and more and more, the effect that has on districts. And so that's been a point of contention that a lot of districts have tried to get the state and the governor to address, because all of this new money that's coming out for districts is basically going to go to that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Next, we have educational services update.
I'd just like to take a moment to formally announce 3 new administrators joining our ranks that have been selected since the last time the board met. We have Sean Allstott, who is, we only have one of them here tonight, but Sean Allstott will be joining us as the new assistant principal at Morro Bay High School. Sean is a sitting assistant principal at Lincoln Middle School in Santa Monica. And he and his wife are very excited to come back up here. He did his undergraduate work at Cal Poly, so he's coming home. And Lincoln Middle School is the school that's much larger as a middle school than Morro Bay High School is as a high school. So I think this will be a great landing for him. We also have selected our own Darla Batistic to be the new principal of Teach Elementary School. Darla's not able to be here tonight, but the board, of course, is very familiar with Darla. And so she's been a longtime educator and teacher on special assignment in our school district, and very excited about having her take the helm at Teach. And the reason she's taking the helm there is because James McMillan, who is back there, stand up, James. He'll be actually addressing the board on another item. James will be taking over as the new principal of Hawthorne Elementary School, and James has grown up with us here in this school district. In fact, I just found out when his name was announced at Hawthorne that his first voluntary assignment as a teacher candidate was at Hawthorne in one of the classes there. So he's going back home there, and we're very happy to have James joining us. So just wanted to make sure the board is aware of all those things in the public. Dr. Prater actually has an announcement to make as part of the update.
Yes, board. 2 weeks ago, I provided you, per your request, with a summary report or analysis of the Napomo Mesa rail spur extension that's being proposed, and it's certainly gaining a lot of attention. And we've had public comment on this particular topic, and you asked me to provide you with a report. I did do that. Following that report, I also met with all the county superintendents in San Luis Obispo County, along with Dr. Brescia, the county superintendent of schools. I shared the report and discussed this issue with them. They were very familiar with the issue, and I was able to discuss how it was impacting each of them in their districts. What I was hoping for tonight was to get your approval, your direction, if you will, the consensus of the board, for me to go back with the collective superintendent group, which they've agreed to do, and have Dr. Brescia write a letter of concern on all of our behalfs regarding the impact that the increased rail traffic will have in our collective county, on the school districts in particular. As you know, and I've shared this with you, it impacts a few of our schools in this district, and Los Ranchos, Hawthorne, our district office, our BG&T yard, and San Luis Obispo High School in particular are the locations where the tracks seem to have the greatest potential to do possible harm. This letter would encapsulate the concern that we in totality share, and also offer to the County Planning Commission, County Board of Supervisors, possible efforts to mitigate that impact. I would like to have your permission to participate in that effort and have that mailed to the Board of Supervisors and the County Planning Commission, as they'll be weighing in on these in the next several months. Also, we would like to submit this letter in a viewpoint in the Tribune, so at least everyone in the county understands that we as educators and their elected officials as trustees have shared their concerns, and I would just like your green light to be able to do that.
So, Dr. Prater, are you seeking consensus of the board tonight to proceed in that direction? Do we have consensus? Mr. Quesenberry, you have...
Just a couple of comments. It's not necessarily not consenting or having consensus. One, I had a discussion with Richard Robles, who formerly worked for the California, well, actually he does on a consulting basis, California Specialized Training Institute, right here off of Highway 1, where they train people for crisis management, and they also teach people how to deal with various hazmat situations, including rail cars and what have you. He pointed out a couple things. He was pretty sure that there's going to be some additional state money for some mitigation, and he thought that would be important for the district, the school district, to know that. He wasn't very specific about it. And then, of course, his point from a crisis management and a hazmat point was that that restrictions can be placed on these rail cars in terms of speed and the quality of the actual tank cars and so forth, which could make them more safe than they currently are, or safer than they currently are. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that to the board's attention, and I would support publishing of a letter and showing the district's concern for the safety of these rail lines and this kind of rail traffic.
Ms. Eisen, Jeff Rogers?
Just one comment, please. I would just like to thank you, Dr. Prater, for taking the initiative to do all this research, doing all the work that you're doing, and taking leadership in this role in this area. I think it's very important. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So just to be clear, we have consensus, it appears.
Thumbs up.
Okay,
well, thank you very much. I met with Dr. Brescia today, and he is in the process of composing this letter using some of the things that I've heard tonight as well, and we should have that submitted in June.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to 7.03 Measure D update.
Yeah, so this Friday we have our board study session, specifically really digging into Morro Bay High School, the plan, site plan, the discussions there, different options. I will be emailing the board kind of a agenda list of items, and we'll put it in the Google Doc so you can, if there's anything you want to add to the discussion. So the idea, we'll spend a few hours with the architect on Morro Bay High School, on what the committee has brought forward, what they've talked about, what the committee's input role has been. Our advisor, Mr. Holcomb, will be there as well to kind of update the board on the things he's seen so far as he's been part of the process. And then we'll also have an opportunity for the board to have input or any other types of items that you would like to see in future board study sessions.
Thank you. All right. Item 8.01, we have a resolution for Classified School Employee Week.
So the next item is for our classified employees, and you saw so many of them here tonight. It was just so nice. So this is a proclamation for May 17th through the 23rd, which is designated as Classified School Employee Week. And I am happy to read it if you would like me to do so.
Sure, why don't you read it into the...
Okay. Whereas classified school employees provide valuable services to the schools and students of the district, and... Whereas classified school employees contribute to the establishment and promotion of a positive instructional environment. And whereas classified school employees serve as a vital role in providing for the welfare and safety of the district students. And whereas classified school employees employed by the district and represented by California School Employees Association, CSEA, and Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and confidential employee units strive for excellence in all areas relative to the educational community. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Trustees of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District hereby recognizes and wishes to honor the contribution of the classified school employees to quality education in the state of California and in the San Luis Coastal Unified School District, and declares the week May 17th through the 23rd, 2015, as Classified School Employee Week, adopted the 19th day of May.
Is there anyone from the public here to address this? All right. We'll come back to the board. Mr. Buckman.
I may have said this before, but it's always amazing to me that as we think of public schools and we think of interaction, we think of the teachers interacting with the children. But in reality, the first person that most students see and the last person that most students see every day is a classified employee. So it's either the bus driver, the school secretary, the custodian. And if they don't set the tone for schools, I don't know who does.
Thank you. Ms. Eisendrath Rogers?
I would just like to move approval of resolution number 17-14-15.
I'll second that.
All right. Roll call vote.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mrs. Schiffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next is the public hearing and first reading on the Local Control Accountability Plan.
So in January of 2013, Governor Brown did something that had never been done in the state of California. He proposed a budget, which actually is done every year by the governor, something he is required to do under the state constitution. But he also suggested a radical departure from the way K-12 school financing and accountability would be handled in our state. He suggested a change in funding that actually shakes up the last time public school financing was overhauled, which began during the Reagan governorship and was ultimately decided by the state Supreme Court during Jerry Brown's first term as governor in 1977. It was called the Serrano versus Priest decision, which changed school funding. He was also the governor when Proposition 13 passed, which also had incredible impacts on K-12 education. So when he terms out, Governor Brown will be able to say he presided over the three greatest overhauls of education spending in the history of this country, which is kind of a fascinating thing. He based his budget, something he nicknamed as a local control plan at the time, on six principles. The first was equity. He believed that school funding should be essentially equalized, but we should provide more money to those students who have the highest needs, kind of like the federal government does with its Title I and Title III funds. Second principle was simplicity. He believed that the process and the budget should be easy to understand. The third principle was one that created some gasps. He said, I want to increase funding to education by $18 billion in the state of California. The fourth principle, he said, was I intend for that $18 billion to be phased over a seven-year period from 2013-14 to 2020-21, at which time he believed we would have fully funded K-12 education. The fifth principle was maximum flexibility, that local communities should be able to decide how to spend their money. And the sixth principle was to increase accountability, something that was more than just what No Child Left Behind said at the federal level, but to actually have academic outcomes directly tied to fiscal resources. So those principles morphed into what is known as the Local Control Accountability Plan, now in our second year of adoption. I think the governor has largely accomplished what he set out to do. Even though as a community-funded basic aid school district, we are not seeing a change in funding, funding is more equitable in our state than ever before. The state is definitely, as we heard from Mr. Pinkerton, kicking in more money to public education every year, which benefits those districts around us in great ways. Categorical funds are pretty much over, so that we truly have local control about how we spend our money with very few strings attached. And there is an expectation of accountability and measurement built into the LCAT. I don't think he's achieved the principle of simplicity, which was one of his principles. Our LCAP, utilizing the current template, is 68 pages long and is not for the faint of heart or the sleep-deprived, but I believe it does ring true. It actually and absolutely is responsible to the needs of our district. So tonight, I do not intend on rehashing our plan again. We did that at our last meeting. We shared the plan. We are focusing on six target areas: English language arts, mathematics, technology and innovation, our culture of care, STEAM and CTE pathways, and an analysis of programs through a data cycle. But by law, we do need to open a formal public hearing so that any member of the public can provide formal input or ask questions. Of course, we welcome any additional board commentary as well. Even though you will open and close the formal hearing momentarily, we do want everyone to know that our plan, including our public feedback, our budget documents, our surveys, are all available on our website. We also will make sure that any questions that are asked will be answered by the superintendent and published on that same website between now and when the board actually formally is asked to adopt the budget, the LCAP, and the LEA plan, which will be at your June 2nd meeting. So at this time, we welcome the board to open the hearing and ask any questions or have the public ask any questions that you may have. Thank you.
We will now open the public hearing. Is there anyone from the public here to discuss this item with the board or administration? All right. Does anyone from the board have questions or comments? Oh, we will now close the public hearing. Mr. Quesenberry, then Mr. Buckman.
This is just a comment on Governor Brown's ambitious reform of funding from public schools. Probably 30 years ago, I think it was Jonathan Colesville wrote a book called Savage Inequalities, which talked about the disparity in public funding for public schools that exists pretty much throughout the United States, where some districts in New York, going by the figures at that time, would be spending something on the order of about $17,000 per student, and less wealthy districts were spending about a third of that. So I commend Governor Brown for this. It's just hard to be on the receiving end of this kind of redistribution, in a way, of public funds. When I still believe that what we provide for our students is not adequate. And anyway, I just thought I'd make that observation before we moved on with this.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I noticed as I was going through it is It's just an amazing job of data collection and pages and pages, and you have to make it match to the school site plan, and it just was amazing the work that went into this, and I appreciate it. Another thing that I noticed was as we talked about the subgroups and the gap and who's proficient and who's not proficient, it became clear to me from the data that while we're putting a lot of effort into the EL students, another group is actually performing with less proficiency and less improvement, and that would be the socioeconomic disadvantaged students. And I don't know. Come on, Amy. Save me here. Thank you.
I appreciate the question. Our socioeconomically disadvantaged students that we designate based on eligibility for free and reduced lunch, though that information is confidential, we don't call out, you know, names of these students. It's a very confidential piece of information. But at the same time, we have a pretty good idea, principals at their schools, teachers at their schools, who are those students that are living in poverty, have special needs that need to be addressed because of the effects of poverty. So what you'll find in the LCAP are programs that support students in poverty without calling out for the students in poverty, because there are also programs that can support other students. An example of that would be after-school transportation for our after-school intervention programs. That's a specific target that we put in place to support students of socioeconomic disadvantage, but can also support other students. Some of those students may, in fact, be English learners, and some of them may not. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Millar.
I just had a kind of a nuts and bolts suggestion to Mr. Robinette, because there's so much boilerplate in the LCAP plan that I suggested, and I'm wondering how the board feels about having the sections that we actually put information in there, do it in a different color type. Because, you know, you're reading for pages before we ever even get to a section that is filled in by our own staff.
So, well, I think that's a really fine idea. It would really jump out at us to know what we're looking at.
I think we can do that before the next board meeting, so you can actually separate it out.
Mr. Unger?
Yeah, I think just thinking kind of about what Walter was saying and the complexity of the LCAP plan itself, I was wondering if on our website we have sort of an executive summary of it in parent-friendly terms. And if we don't, I realize that that's actually going to be quite a bit of work. I know that. But I think for our parents and for our community to be able to just get a sense of what we're trying to accomplish, aligned with the priorities that we have, I think that could be a good thing, because I think we're doing good work, and I think we need to let the community know about it. Next year, I think, is going to be we'll be taking input for our third year on the LCAP. So I don't think 16-17 is when we have to do the redo. I think it's 17-18, right? But just kind of getting people ready for it, getting people thinking about it, and like I said, giving them ways of knowing it. And, you know, I know we've sort of talked about, I'm going to sort of veer off for a second, but sort of talked about it, a data dashboard for the website, and, you know, kind of hopefully get into that place too, which could align with the LCAP and our initiatives.
Mr. Unger, I appreciate that. What the board doesn't know is we've been sharing concepts of in the county about different templates. And one of the templates that was flying around this last weekend was almost like a cliff note, if you want to call it an executive summary, but it was really a condensed, really simplified template around what exactly we're doing and about what we're spending our money on and what target group we're focusing in on. And I really liked it. It was 3 or 4 pages, something you could really understand. And so I know everyone on the team is super busy right now, but I got the thumbs up from Amy over there, sort of the nodding from Diane, and Kim is smiling. So I think we'll be able to get that going by June 2nd. We'll see what we can do. No promises, but I think we can.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. Any further discussion on this topic? All right, next we have the public hearing and first reading of the proposed 2015-2016 budget.
Wrong ones. Take care.
Come on up, Julie. So again, public hearing tonight, first reading of the budget. We're going to review some information with the board. I'm going to start off by going through some of the items that we actually shared with our staff as we went around and did our LCAP hearings. One is a fund trend history, kind of our district and the funds from, I think, 2002-03 up until 2013-14. Julie's going to then talk about this year's budget, next year's proposed budget, and then I'll kind of finish it off with a seven-year budget summary. So actually, if you go back to the item, Kim, and click on the fund trend history. First one. So these are, again, all of these items are all on our LCAP page. If you go to About on the district website, it has LCAP. You click on it, and the link will show this. So you can even blow it up a little bit, Kim, for just the top part. So one of the things coming into this job, and actually as a personnel director, as I went around to school sites and talked to people, it was, well, the district's hiding money. Where is everything? You know, how do we know what the funds are? And so kind of going into my job now as the Assistant Super Business Services was, there's no secrets. The money's there. It's actually in the SACS form. Every time we do a budget, you can see exactly what the district has. But again, kind of like the executive summary, like Chris talked about, could we do something that's just kind of a quick, you know, display of what the funds are, what they've been? And so that's basically what you have in front of you with this fund trend history is the district from 2002-03 to 2012-13-14, and just some key highlights. We definitely saw huge increases in property tax revenues over that time period. And anybody who owns a home in San Luis Obispo knows that in 2002-03 what their home value was worth versus now in 2013-14 what their home value is worth, and property taxes have increased over time. And so that's a positive thing for the district, positive for our revenue stream as a basic aid school district. Our expenditures have also increased during those same time periods that you'll see. So we've given, you know, raises to our employees, cost of living, all of those things have gone up over the time. And just stay up with the top, Kim. So I'm just going to go through kind of each one. So revenues, again, as you'll see, that really the hit as you go, and if you go all the way to 13-14, Kim, if you scoot over a little bit. So we noticed that the 11-12, 12-13 years, you'll see that huge drop in our revenues during those 2 years. So that is when the fair share reductions with the categorical funds hit the district. And we, you know, we grappled with some huge losses and had to, you know, go through some layoffs and other things because our revenues and expenditures were definitely off during those 2 years. But prior to that, you see kind of a growth, again, where revenues are going up. Even with expenditures, you see our bottom line, which is the fourth line down. So our kind of our reserve level and the amount of money that we had with the district also increased. So again, just showing the positive from 2002-03 until that 11-12 school year, we saw real growth in all areas. So we were also, while our ending balance was going up, we also were putting money, the board was putting money towards Fund 20 for our post-retirement benefits. And so, it kind of shows that. Now, we 11-12, when the fair share reductions hit, that was definitely a tough time for the district. On top of that, from the 2010 to 2012-13 school years, we also had zero increases in property tax revenues. So we kind of flatlined revenues and had the hit as well from our categorical funds. So 13-14 balanced the budget. We actually had a surplus that year of $900,000, mainly due to the extra Common Core funds that we had received in 13-14 and we didn't expend until this year. So again, it's kind of a snapshot where the district was. It has all of our other funds also that are outlined on this document, so our Fund 20, our cafeteria fund, developer fee fund, so county school fees. You'll see some of those, like the tax override, some of those funds ended and have zero balances ongoing, and that'll be something that as Julie, over time, over the years, those funds zero out, they'll basically come off of the chart. So, again, kind of a snapshot of the district moving forward. And again, I think the board did a great job in terms of getting that reserve balance, going through some tough times prior to the 2003 school year, funding Fund 20, employee compensation, all of really a positive time. So, that said, I'm going to have Julie talk about kind of this year and corresponding into next year's budget. Yes. Question?
I just wanted to point out that from about 07-08 or 08-09 school year on, we had increasing enrollment, which also magnified the impacts that we experienced in those outer 09-10, 10-11, 11-12. And the trends, if they continue, we will still have relatively modest but increasing student enrollment.
Yeah. Yeah, which probably also helped with the years where you see the decline in the 04-05. And so definitely the number of students we have corresponds to the number of teachers we have and resources that are available for those kids. So, but again, hopefully that's the type of chart, type of information that's quick, easy, people can see. It's all out there. It's available for them. And I think it was a nice tie, especially for our employees, to see this, where we were, and then also to see kind of the difficulties we currently face. And it really connects with the seven-year budget. So seeing that long-term projection and how that plays out. So, but Julie's going to go ahead and present this year's proposed budget.
Please. Good evening. So tonight we are presenting our 14-15 estimated actuals, which is basically just the way our budget from this year looks as of a particular date, which I think was May 2nd or something like that, and our 15 and 16 budget. So for our estimated actuals, we looked at our revenues, and we really expect our revenues to come in pretty much the way they're budgeted. Federal and local revenues, sometimes if we don't spend those are deferred until next year. So there, if you see those go down, that's just a movement of those revenues from one year to the next. But as usual, we expect our expenditures will be less than we have budgeted right now. So we're estimating about $800,000 in carryover that'll be reflected in next year's budget when we know the amount. And then there's a lot that is still encumbered, and we expect that not everything that's encumbered is going to be spent. So we're thinking that maybe another $1 million will fall down to the bottom line. So what that would look like is our revenues would be as they are in the budget. Our expenses would be a little bit less than we have budgeted, so we're estimating about between $81 and $82 million. Which would decrease the deficit from what's actually in our estimated actuals budget to $3,461,000, down from about $5,200,000, which would increase our ending fund balance estimate to $16 million rather than $14 million. For the 15-16 budget, we're estimating our revenues at $80,353,000. Going into that is a 3% property tax increase. We met with the county assessor's office, and they actually think that property tax values are going to go up by 5%, but that most of that is going to be because of Prop 8 increases, which probably won't happen as much in San Luis Obispo City as in other parts of the county where assessments were actually decreased during the recession. So we're being conservative at 3%. In the budget is one-time mandated cost reimbursement. This is at $180 per ADA. We didn't know about the May revise amount for the budget, but they're estimating that it could be as much as $580 per ADA now. There are no MA revenues budgeted because it's still really uncertain. We're not sure what's happening with those revenues. We still haven't gotten anything for this year yet, so. And as usual, we don't budget donations and we don't budget billing revenues until we know what they are and they've actually come in. Special ed revenues, we get an estimate from the County Office of Ed, and those are budgeted as they've given us. Contributions to special ed are about $6.8 million. We received another homeless ed grant, which will last for three years, and that's in the budget. And we also have our transfer in from Fund 20, which is our other post-employment benefit fund, the transfer in to cover our retiree benefits.
Okay. So the nearly $7 million that we're talking about is contributions to special education. That's our local contribution, which some people would call encroachment. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. And then on the expenditure side, we also have about $80 million budgeted, so it's pretty balanced. This includes step and column increases only to salaries. Benefits, you can see that our STRS rate went up from 8.88% to 10.73%. That's in there. Our PERS rate actually didn't go up as much as they anticipated, so it went from 11.771% to 11.847%. We were originally thinking it was going to be around 12.6%, so that was some good news, too. Health and welfare is currently budgeted with a 6% increase, but we're going to look at that after the open enrollment. We never really know where people are going to land with that, so we'll reevaluate that and bring that back to you at first interim with any adjustments.
Julie, yes. If I can, mm-hmm. When you talk about expenditure assumptions and you talk about step and column increases only, does that mean we're not including the most recent negotiations?
That's already in this year's budget.
Okay.
So going forward into next year, right. It's just step and column.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. What's not included in our expenditure budget for next year is anything for vehicle replacement. There's no computer replacement budget, and there's no transfer to Fund 20, which is our retirement benefit fund. So we'll bring that back probably also after we see our unaudited actuals to see exactly what our ending balance is going to be. So I just wanted to tell you how this budget relates to the LCAP. So what we've done is we've tried to identify LCAP expenditures by using discretionary codes, which you don't need to know that, but just to let you know that we really are identifying those expenditures, we use discretionary codes 3910 through 3960. And within that, we also have the LCAP supplemental budgeted, which is the expenditures we're supposed to spend on the low socioeconomic and foster youth and ELs. And that's budgeted in a separate resource. We have those identified as well. So you can see for our mathematics focus area, we have $609,000 budgeted. Language arts right now, we have $1.9 million. STEAM and CTE is about $401,000. Culture of care is about $990,000. Technology and innovation is $306,000. And data cycle, we have about $466,000 right now budgeted. This is a look at, this is actually an updated chart from what you have in your narrative. And this reflects the 53% gap funding for the LCFF amount. So if you look at these three lines, the blue line is our property taxes. It kind of looks like a roller coaster there. The red line is the base revenue limit, which is what the revenue limit would have been had they not deficited it. So you can see in 7-8 was the last time those two lines were together. That was an undeficited revenue limit year. After that, if we had been a revenue limit district, that green line would have been what we received as a revenue limit. And then in 13-14 was our first year as LCFF. So the green line included that increase for LCFF. And now the green line is, with the 53%, is getting a little bit closer to that blue line. But I also did an analysis in future years, and I think if we continue to get at least 2% property tax, I don't think that we're going to become an LCFF district anytime in the relatively near future. This is what Ryan was talking about. We're going to have to bring this back to you as a public hearing at the next board meeting. As you know, the state is now requiring that we have to explain if we have a reserve level that's over the minimum. So Ed Code 42127 requires that we identify the minimum required, which you can see at the top there is $2,413,000. And then we also have to identify what's over that reserve and what we're using it for. So as you know, we have to keep our adult ed balance identified because we're still using that to spend for adult ed purposes. We have a little bit left in Arts and Music Block Grant. After this year, that'll be all used up because we're not getting any new money in there. Instructional materials is the biggest thing, really, that we keep carrying over, and that's because we know that we're going to have more Common Core expenditures. We know we're going to have textbook adoptions. Eventually, they're not going to keep giving us mandated cost money, so we're kind of reserving that for future expenditures. The catastrophic leave balance really is for the employees that contribute to that, so we're not going to spend that. We have carryover that isn't budgeted yet, but we know we're going to carry it over, so we're estimating that at $743,000. We always keep 1 year worth of lottery in reserves, so that's what that is. And the EPA budget will be used next year as well. And then the board has authorized our reserve for economic uncertainties at 10%, so that's actually 7% above what it has to be as a minimum. So that's that $5.6 million. So our total assigned balance at budget is $10,300,000. We also have $592,000 that's unassigned, and this will be used for future expenditures that we need for computer replacement or vehicle replacement. We just haven't actually assigned it yet. So to identify these reserves in excess of the minimum, we have $10,892,547 that are in excess of that minimum amount of reserve. So our total assigned and unassigned reserves with the minimum are $13,306,000. We also have $889,000 that are considered unspendable, committed, or restricted balances. And that brings us up to our ending fund balance estimate. Oh, and then Ryan is going to go over the seven-year budget with you.
So kind of a broad sweep with what Julie just said. So 13-14, we had about $900,000 surplus, mainly because we hadn't spent our Common Core funds that we had that year, but we had balanced the budget. This year, we had a balanced budget going into the year. We gave a 4% increase to staff, retro, throughout the year was about over $2.5 million. And we ended up spending those Common Core funds because they had to be spent by the end of this school year. That's why you're seeing about a $3 million swing versus expenditures versus revenues for this particular school year. We'll see where that actually ends once Julie and her team closes the books, and where we're at, we'll be coming back with that information to the board, add on an unaudited actuals in September. With that, we have taken the information and we have a balanced budget actually for next year. We're 15-16. Our certificated salaries, actually, even with the 4.5% due to retirements, due to other changes and some of the reductions that we've made, have actually stayed the same. So certificated salaries, what you'll see, and again, that's on the next page, so I'll talk about it in a minute, but certificated salaries have actually stayed the same. So classified salaries have gone up a little bit, which I'll show you, but the STIRS impact, that $700,000 increase from last year, that's what has kind of increased, you know, made the increase. And even with the 3% property tax, that increase is basically taking up that extra revenue we're bringing in. And so that becomes really clear as you look through the seven-year budget. But we'll start with, again, so what we've done is we know 13-14, when we started the seven-year budget, at unaudited actuals, we put the real information in. That is where we ended the year. So in September of this coming year, 2015, we will have our unaudited actuals, what the reality of where we ended, and that information will be put in 14-15. Everything else are projections. Julie has taken what kind of our last 5-6 years of what we've received in revenues and expenditures and extrapolated that out. So again, this is not for sure perfect, but it's a projection for the board to see and kind of know where we're at. And so those key areas, when you look at seven-year budget in terms of revenue, we know that in 1920 is when the Prop 30 tax increase ends. What I described earlier in the May revise, the categorical funds, that's the $3.1 million that if LCFF is fully funded that we could potentially lose. Hopefully that legislation will go through this year and will ensure that 3 million stays there in our projection. We've tried to, again, not be too conservative, yet not be too liberal in terms of our projection moving forward. And so the fact that things like we're not receiving MA funds, we've taken it out of the projection. So we've done that as we've kind of proceeded. So those are the key. Again, after hearing from the county assessor's office, we feel like 3% is a solid number for us to use for our projections. Just so you know, they said 5% last year, too, and it ended up being about 3.3%. So I don't think we're going to get a 5%, but I'm hopeful. I would love for it to be higher than the 3 that we projected. It'd be great, because that's ongoing revenue for us, right, if those property taxes go up. So that would be great. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. And, again, we'll know that better in October, so we'll be able to bring that information back to the board as well. And that's kind of the first interim is where we share that information with the board. Everything else is kind of stable as we go through. Federal money, again, pretty stable as we go through. We have our homeless ed grant we were able to extend based on they got the grant renewed. As you go down, again, Common Core funds, we've only put in the $15-16. So for next year, we have $1.5 million currently based on that $180 the governor said in January. So there's the potential, should that, and it will wait and see what really happens, but there's the potential of adding another $3 million to that revenue source, one-time money, which, again, will help us in our bottom line, but is not a ongoing source that can assist us over the next 5-6 years as we move forward. It definitely helps. And then we've, again, looking at our local kind of tuition, interest payments, those types of things. Of course, interest levels are still super, super low. We have our money in the county treasury. It's not a big source of income for us. And then we do, throughout, we try to plan for both putting money into Fund 20, taking money out of Fund 20, so that we maintain that level. You know, if we could put more money in, it would be great to get to that $14 million actuarial number, but having $9 to $10 million in that is a great place for the district to be. So, Kim, if you go down to expenditures. So, again, certificated, you'll see from 14-15 to 15-16, actually a little decline currently, which seems hard to believe with a 4% increase, right, for staff. But we had, how many retirements did we end up having? Kristen? So about 20 employees retiring. So that, you know, that's a great thing in terms of for our bottom line. Not great that we lose great teachers, of course, but in terms of from a budgetary standpoint. And now Julie's made projections on those reductions. So depending on who we hire, if we hire a person who has 10 years experience versus we hire somebody who has 1 year experience, that number can change. So just so you know, right, and that information, of course, gets flushed out, and at first interim will present much better ideal numbers at that time. So classified, you see a little increase over last year. But really the point that I want to highlight is the STIRS increase. So you see from 14-15, it was $3.3 million. Next year, $4 million. So, and really when you think about that, we had a reduction in certificated salaries, and the benefits went up $700,000. So $700,000 every year, more than what it currently is. So 1.4 next year, then 2.1, then 2.8. I mean, it's that is something that we have to be cautious of. When we had those couple of tough years, 11-12, that we talked about, that was when our personnel costs jumped up to the 92% level. So that's dangerous ground for us. We want to maintain an 85%, if at all possible, salary to revenue situation. Now, next year we get the extra $3 million. Hey, you just look at, you divide it out. It looks like, hey, look, we're way down in terms of our overall revenues and what our salary percentage is because of those one-time mandated costs. But we have to be cautious of that because then the following year when you don't get those revenues, it jumps way up. And so that's why this projection, I think, is a nice thing for us to have and to continue to look for. And as the years go on, we'll add additional years and take off, you know, the 13-14 and move that to the fund trend data. So the other one is PERS. Again, it's interesting. PERS actually, they recalculated their retirement costs. So they actually lowered their estimate, unlike STRS. So that was something that Julie had talked about, that it was a little less than we had anticipated. So that's reflected. And then really the other key area for the board that I want to highlight is really the health benefits. So you see health benefits going from $6.3 million in 2013-14 to close to $9 million by 2021 with those 5% increases throughout the year. So that is, again, same number of staff, more money, more personnel costs. And so that's the tough area for us, is to keep it within that 85% if we can. Because when we don't, when we get to 87, 88%, that 2 or 3% is how we purchase computers and new cars and new playgrounds and supplies and all those other things. And so it represents a substantial amount of money. And so it's just something we have to maintain that balance. And we know we're a people business, and we have to do that. But we definitely want to keep our eye on that overall cost, I think, throughout. You'll see a little bit of a spike in terms of materials and supplies this year because of the Common Core funds we spent. That'll drop back down to a normal materials and supplies budget in the future. And then if it's okay with the board, I like to come back to the board in August when we have our unaudited actuals, when we know where we're at, we have a much better picture, and then ask the board for approval for those extra items that we add outside of the normal, staffing and LCAP and those things. So the vehicle replacement, bus replacement that we've done, all those other things that we do. So snapshot, again, it looks like with the $3 million added in the mandated cost, you'll see that we'll be in a much better situation in terms of this school year, right? And that bottom line ending balance is going to jump up a lot. So while that will help us over the next few years, it doesn't solve our problems ongoing. So we'll have to, again, continually watch that, maintain, and ensure that we're on top of all of the different budget areas and particularly those personnel expenditures. So that's kind of the presentation tonight. It's a public hearing, so we wanted to share, kind of give the board a totality update, have the public hearing, and then we'll be back at the next board meeting for budget approval.
Thank you. We'll open the public hearing. Is there anyone here to address the board on the public hearing of the first reading of the proposed 2015-2016 budget? We will close the public hearing and come back to the board. Any board questions, comments? We'll just start at that end, Mr. Unger, then Mr. Buckman.
Well, I thank you. I really appreciate what you're talking about, especially the STRS and PERS things. And I do want folks to know that that it is continuing to be a discussion among education, the education groups up in Sacramento as well as throughout California. Jim, you mentioned adequacy. Just so that you know, I was at a meeting today, as a matter of fact, and this weekend. Adequacy in terms of school boards is something that we want to continue to determine, because adequacy, for example, I believe in Prop 98 is defined as 10% is in the top 10, well, is in the top 10 funded states in California, and of course we're not there. Depending on who you believe, we're 26th, 27th, or 46th. You know, it just depends on what figures you want to know about. But CSBA continues to push forward on their adequacy lawsuit, and so that. But one of the things we have to do is define what adequacy is. So it's kind of an interesting, difficult conversation. One thing I wanted to say about this particular budget, though, I'm just so excited that you guys pulled codes and you assigned codes to the LCAP funds that go to the specific target groups, because this is exactly what people in California are talking about for transparency. And I'm just thrilled that we're calling out those separate funds that you can do through your codes. Did I hear you say that we're also that you have a separate set of codes that looks at how we're spending money for our target groups as well? That is phenomenal. That, again, I can't say enough positive about that and what we're doing, because this was the argument that we would be hiding funds and that
that any group, that any civil rights group, for example, that wanted to know if we were spending our money appropriately for our targeted groups, our concentration groups, even though we don't get that money, we're doing it. And then
highlight that too, Chris, in that with our LCAP, if you counted up those expenditures, right, it's about $4.7 million.
Yeah.
So what we are supposed to spend if we were fully funded is about $4.2 million. So we're actually, the district, the board, is putting a lot of investment in those students.
That's great. And then the last thing, just thinking about the reserve cap, we know that I think tax receipts come in twice yearly. So do we use our reserves to cover the time when between tax revenues, tax time?
Yes, we do. Okay. Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
we haven't had to take out any kind of loans or anything in the
last. So we don't have to do trans or anything like that?
Trans,
for those who don't know, are temporary loans that we would get,
right,
just cut to make sure that we have cash to pay our employees. So just for anybody that's listening or watching, that's another reason why we need to absolutely repeal this reserve cap.
Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. I, too, want to compliment you on the ability. This is probably the best budget synopsis document that I've seen, both as a report all the time, and it's wonderful. And I really want to also thank Julie, I think, for putting that column down the side with the percents, because that really works for me. As I was going through, I something that I never thought about before, we show a line item on page 4 that talks about investments, and it's got a dollar amount attached to it. So if you could tell me where we have those investments, and I think I have a follow-up question.
That, I believe, without seeing exactly what you're looking at, but I think that's what we have in the LAIF fund, which stands for, no, it's not the, it's, thank you, Local Agency Investment Fund, which is a state-pooled fund. We have about $3 million up there, and it fluctuates. Sometimes it earns more than the county treasury, and sometimes it doesn't, but, yeah.
Okay, and so So one of the questions that seems to be going around organizations and colleges and other groups that have investments is what is that exactly invested in? So for me, if it was invested, say, in tobacco, I might be fairly unhappy.
I could give you a report that you could go to their website and get. I mean, it's very diversified.
Okay.
It's kind of like the county treasury. It's a state-pooled fund.
Okay. Is that something that we, if the board's interested, that we might be able to get in the Friday Focus?
Well, it sounds like.
Or just the website.
You could go to the website. And
we can share the website.
Sure.
Thanks. That's all I'm asking. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Millar.
Just in general, how are we in Fund 20 as far as fully funding our benefits, contingent benefits? Ballpark's fine.
We're going to get another actuarial done this next year. At the moment, we're still working off the last actuarial, which was at about set it at about $14 million, and I think it's hovering around between $9 and $10 million, depending on whether we are able to fund it through
14,
the general fund.
14 would be roughly what we would need to have in there to fully fund our current future benefits.
Correct.
And the reason I ask is because we have transferred in and out to Fund 20 to both for cash flow and for bridging purposes. And I'm wondering if the reserve cap thing doesn't go our way, can we fully fund Fund 20 or more fully fund Fund 20 and then have those dollars available?
I would hope so. In our audit, you may have noticed that they combine Fund 20 with our general fund and combine that into one big reserve.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard that they'll do that, but if they don't, I would think that would be a great use for it.
The key, as I read, as you look at through the reserve, is just that the board has to dedicate the funds. So you have to appropriate them, even if we have above the reserve, as long as the board has a rationale and reasoning for what those funds are appropriated to, then you're fine. You just have to outline that. You have to have the public hearing. But the fact that we even have to do that is something that I think, you know, with CSBA and other groups, you know, taking charge of that. And then, of course, there has to be some really key economic things happen for us to even, for that to happen, where the reserve fund would kick in terms of maintaining that. And then there's the county office can actually
The county office doesn't want us to have a low reserve either, and they're the ones that are going to approve this.
Right.
So I don't.
Yeah, I'm just worried that, you know, out about 3 or 4 years, we may have some real bridging challenges like we did before, and so every source of money where we can do that is going to be important.
Absolutely.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Going back to page 6, I believe it is, of the presentation, under the LCAP budget. There we go. I was wondering, what could you tell me what data cycle means? And we have $466,000 devoted to it, and I'm not sure exactly what it means.
I think Amy is going to come up and answer that question for you. Okay. I just put the numbers in.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the dollar signs by the penny, please. But if in the LCAP plan, that's our sixth goal, data cycle. So everything that's listed in the LCAP under that is represents those funds.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't remember everything that was listed under item 6.
My guess is I can't either right now at this point, but I'm going to see what I can do. I know this pays for one full-time assessment TOSA. It pays for what will now be a half-time assessment TOSA because the other half of that person will now be the principal of Teach Elementary School. It pays for both elementary and secondary scoring days, of which we're going way down next year in elementary to one writing scoring day for teachers being pulled out. In secondary, there will be, help me, days for both writing and for math, scoring days where teachers are pulled out and work together as a professional development to develop those. Those are what I can come off without even thinking about it.
That's good. That gives me a bit of a sense of it, because what I'm trying to get at, that's data cycle, then we have technology and innovation. And I don't know. I thought that we had established or we had committed to an ongoing sinking fund for replacement, computer replacement, and I don't find it in the budget. Is it here?
It's not in the budget. No. Currently.
Did we have it in the budget last year?
We did.
Okay.
We added it in, once we knew where the budget was at, once we knew where kind of the bottom line, where unaudited actuals were at, we brought those items back to the board, and then that's when we put those in the budget and funded.
So that would be something that we would look at when we,
absolutely,
when we know the actuals, then we would be looking at, you know, fleet replacement, and technology would be another thing
technology,
that we would be looking
replacing
at that
another
time.
Playground, you know, all those kind of one-time expenditures as we go through would definitely be things that I would bring forward to the board.
Okay, and then I had one other question. Uh-oh, I think it might have left my mind. It was somewhere in here, and actually, Mr. Pinkerton, you and I discussed it. It was kind of a misnomer that talks about monies going to the sixth grade STEAM program at Los Osos Middle School. And I don't know where it was, but I inquired about, I thought that we initially set the sixth grade STEAM program up with some seed monies to get started. And then I wondered why we were still continuing to fund them. And as it turns out, the answer was that we funded the sixth grade program with computers.
And furniture.
And furniture, you know, with their STEAM needs. And then now in this past year, we funded the seventh grade program so that the monies that are in the budget, wish I could find the page, guys, but I'm sorry, I can't. Actually, although it reads sixth grade STEAM,
it really
it's for the eighth grade.
It really should say Los Osos STEAM program, not just sixth grade.
It completes the middle school STEAM
model.
Establishment.
If you will. Okay, so I don't know if anybody else, if anyone else noticed that, but I did, and that was the answer to that question.
So we're not continually just putting more money into sixth grade, just so you know. So it was sixth grade, this year 7th grade, next year 8th grade. And it was a great catch. Good thing we should. It shouldn't just say 6th grade on it.
Well, that's okay. But then beyond that, in the next budget year, we'll be looking at how do we carry those children forward
to 9th grade or Morro Bay High.
The 9th grade.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
As well as what's the plan to continue the program at LUMS as well with replacement, those types of things. So we'll have to work with the sites.
Thank you.
Mr. Unger?
Yeah, Walter, just kind of a concern about the reserve cap. There are people that believe that it could be triggered as early as 16-17 based on the increased revenues from the state. So there's concern out there about that. And then I just, for anybody listening, I would like to talk about interest for a minute. We only talk about $30,000 to $50,000 a year in interest, and the reason is we put it in very safe places. And that's a result of the Orange County debacle from the early 90s, where millions of dollars was lost because of inappropriate investments. And so we want to make sure that our prop money is safe.
Anything else?
Ken, Madam Chair. Ryan, we talked about this briefly, but I just need clarification. Within the budget, it talks about a line... Form 01, page 7, getting better at keeping track. Vocational and applied technology education. It's down a little bit. It's basically $41,000. But it's really not a dollar question so much, Julie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's really more of a understanding what that term means. So for me, that term sort of means that old hands-on ROP-type program where the kids are really working with cars and wood and electricity. And is that true, or is this really money?
Is there a dollar amount in there?
I'm sorry, please?
Is there a dollar amount in there?
Yes, there is, about $41,000.
It's probably our Perkins money.
Oh, okay. So can that be used for... can that be used for CTE, or is it really, really sort of focused on... Or is it really focused?
Umbrella.
It is. It's not focused on maintaining those hands-on programs.
Yes, Perkins is within the larger umbrella of CTE, so it's looking at funding those type of programs that have a clear pathway for mm-hmm. students. So, in order to qualify for Perkins, there's a few qualifications, and yes, they're all CTE courses under that larger umbrella, but they have to have a sequence of courses, mm-hmm. have leadership opportunities, have a, you know, there's a few different requirements in order to be funded by Perkins, but yes, it is enhancing those career tech electives.
Okay. So when we talk about the CTE pathways and that type of thing, ultimately does that lead to a point where students may have hands-on activities?
Absolutely. All CTE. I think it would be hard to find a CTE course that didn't have engaging hands-on opportunities for students. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. All right, our next item is 9.03, and it is how Illuminate is supporting instruction.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me tonight. I'm here on behalf of Instructional Services, Learning and Achievement, as well as IS&T for one of my final tasks for the year with the unique position that I had this year. I got excited back there. You might have seen me raise my hand a little bit because I've heard on more than one occasion more than one board member mention the D word tonight. That's not what you're thinking. The word is data. So that is what I'm here to talk about. Next slide, please. So in a very, very brief amount of time, this is what I'd like to go over. I'd like to give you a background of how we chose to use the Illuminate software. I'd like to briefly describe it, and more importantly, let some of our teacher leaders do a better job at describing and showing through some videos that we've collected. That will show you the current uses, and then we hope to provide you with next steps as we move forward in planning for next year. So this is the background. And what started off as our initiatives for student success have now become our six focus areas, which have been mentioned multiple times tonight. And under the initiatives, the words data-rich culture were commonly used. And that was kind of our first big exposure to thinking about data and how it applies to education. Now, under the focus areas, the term has kind of morphed into data cycles. And I know that a couple have just spoken about that, and I'll go into more detail about what the data cycle involves. But it plays a big part in using the Illuminate software. Back when we had the initiatives, we had a software program called Data Director. We had it up until last year. At the end of last year, I sat in a webinar with Darla Batistic, and we were being introduced to the Illuminate software. It's actually a spin-off of Data Director. I'm not sure if it's now a rival company or if it was an amicable split, but it is much more elaborate of a program and has allowed us to do much more with data that we're collecting on student achievement. So that's where we are. We've had Illuminate for 1 year now. This is the login screen that many teachers have become familiar with this year. Illuminate is a web-based software. That means that you log into it on the internet. You don't have to have it loaded on computers or anything. You can also access it from a tablet or a phone even. It's a program used for collecting, organizing, and more importantly, analyzing data. It's used for K-12. One of the most important aspects is that it's integrated with our new standards-based elementary report card. It has many, many sub-features, because at its core, all you do is you enter data into the program and it prints reports for you. But what you can do with those reports, how you can basically imagine if you were to create a report specifically for what you would need and to track something over time to where it became seamless, that's what we're able to do with Illuminate. Two of the sub-features of Illuminate are called GradeCam and GradeBook. One of our teachers is going to tell you about that shortly. And there is an assessment item bank full of thousands of questions. They are not just multiple choice. They range in a variety. And we are starting to use that assessment bank to create our very own personalized San Luis Coastal assessments to start tracking student achievement and better prepare students for the SBAC assessment. This is what you would see typically when you log in. It's a very user-friendly program. On the right side there is a favorites list. One of the problems with Data Director was that it was hard to navigate. Teachers complained, all right, I know how to log in. Where do you want me to click to enter my my reading grades for my kindergartners? Where do you want me? Now it's all organized. Basically, we're talking two clicks. Teachers love that. This next page shows a variety of types of screens that you'll see when you're in Illuminate. There's one up here that's an English language arts profile that covers reading, writing, performance over a year's period. There's a Bridges math assessment profile up here. A really fun feature is that we can pre-fill out middle school registration cards with student data now, with a simple click. And a fun part we like to call the donut. The donut is a really quick and easy visual, particularly at the elementary level, that helps us understand who's got it, who's close to getting it, who doesn't have it yet. We like the donut. So I have four very quick clips of some of our star teachers using Illuminate. We wanted to show you what's happening out on sites at a variety of levels. We have elementary all the way up through secondary. The clips are very quick. They will cover these four areas. I mentioned that there's a tie-in to the report card. There's a gradebook feature, which we're really excited about because we basically customize a gradebook to meet our needs. We're talking formative and summative assessment here and getting more streamlined in using those two types of assessments. GradeCam is a wonderful feature. Think Scantrons upped to the next level, all right? And in moving forward for next steps, we're going to tie it into the student-centered coaching cycle, which I believe Amy Shields has covered in a previous board meeting. So without further ado, I'd like to show you a minute's worth of what GradeCam is.
GradeCam specifically in class to guide assessments.
This is a GradeCam sheet where you get a bubble in your answers from the test, and you get to scan it under a computer to see what questions you got right and what questions you got wrong. Every individual student has one, and they're covered in plastic, so you get to bubble it in, but you can also erase it to change your answers.
When students scan their forms, they have an instant feedback of exactly which standards and which set of questions they need to review.
Or just drop on one. This is it.
The teacher wanted me to make sure that you knew this was a pre-assessment. That's why the scores are so low.
One of the things that I can do on the fly is be able to recognize patterns of questions that students are frequently missing so that I can then take a mid-test break and kind of address that, or go in with another question and identify the standard that we need to look at next. GradeCam is more efficient than other grading assessment systems we've used, because it keeps the students engaged, it keeps them focused, and it's very simple to use.
So that's GradeCam. It's a feature in Illuminate, and most upper grade classrooms are using GradeCam in some form or fashion currently.
Is that basically a document camera that we use to project things up on the... So we're also using it for scanning?
That's exactly what it is. Next we have, that was Emily O'Brien in fourth grade, by the way, at Bishop's Peak. Next we have Lauren Villa. This is Eldra Avery. I got a little excited. I wanted to show you GradeCam at the secondary level. If you guys know Eldra, just fasten your seatbelts. That's all I'm going to say.
So this year, as one of my goals for the year, I said that I would learn to use Illuminate. And this is why I love it. I have all of my AP multiple choice exams on here. And it's really cool because you can print the Scantrons on your trusty printer, okay? And so what I'm doing is I'm having them practice what it's like to take the AP exam. Now, the real beauty of this is when I want to grade them,
there's the donut.
I just push a scan. And then you have to turn your camera on, okay? Then I have all my stacks and it scans them. But what's gorgeous is it not only scans them, but it sorts them. So I know what the performance was for my class. And all I have to do is click on reports, and I get these amazing reports. And so I can get all my class periods. Then I just click submit, and then like magic, that's everybody. So that's all my students. That's how they did. The best part, I now take that report and it gives me a question by question analysis. So this is, it's thorough feedback with a whole year's practice. Okay, so I have, for the AP class, I have 13 multiple choice and 2 finals. So they have 15 practices on AP multiple choice examinations with 15 analysis sections that I use as the teacher to understand what kind of questions give them the most trouble, what kind of questions they're most successful at, and this is what you're really going to love. If I take multiple choice 1 and compare it with multiple choice 13, I can see the the distance that they've spanned and how they've improved over the course of the year. Voila! I mean, honestly, if your course has multiple choice exams that are kind of integral to what you're teaching, you have to try this. So just put it in your school go next year. And ta-da, there you have it. Thank you.
I actually had about 15 minutes of footage there that we had to cut down. She's really excited about it. She jumped right on board, and it's a perfect model because our high schoolers are living in the world of taking assessments and showing what you know, and oftentimes it is that multiple choice. So she's able to instantly use multiple choice assessments in her classroom. We went in meeting with her, we talked about the other types of questions beyond multiple choice, and she's really excited about that maybe as potential for next year. Next, we have Lauren Villa. She's going to tell you how using Illuminate integrates with our new standards-based report card, as well as a feature called Gradebook. Only a few teachers were daring enough to try a Gradebook out this year, and she's one of them. But her work has kind of paved the way, and a lot of teachers are excited about it next year.
Okay, so this year our new report card is loaded into Illuminate, and I'm able to open it up standard by standard so that I can assess students, evaluate that assessment, and enter in the grades according to each standard. This has streamlined the process tremendously. So with this process, there's the fill down option. So I could fill down, say, a 3, because that's generally the most common grade that students are earning. And then with students that earn 1s and 2s and 4s, I can quickly go back in, change those grades, and hit enter, and it's saved in the report card. This year with Illuminate, I piloted the gradebook, and this is what it looks like when you first open the screen. I have my list of gradebooks according to standard. I've clicked on one of my gradebooks. This is my math gradebook. So you can see that it is organized by assignment. You can see that it is color-coded for the grade that the student earned. With Illuminate comes the item bank assessment maker. So with that, you can do multiple types of assessments, one of them being multiple choice, which you can grade with GradeCam, but that's not the only type. So as you know, on SBAC, there are multiple choice questions, so that's a good preparation for that. But in addition, there's constructed response, there's drag and drop, there's math equations, multiple types of assessment building tools. In leading to next year, this year I've seen an effect on me personally as a teacher and making my job easier as a teacher. Next year I see this really affecting the students a lot more. Next year we hope to go to online testing, so students will, not only can we create the assessments on Illuminate, but students can also take the assessments through Illuminate through a student portal. Parents could also have access to that student portal, helping with that student-parent-teacher communication. And then the last thing that I'm really excited about as a member of the grading consortium is the link between the gradebook and our report card. So we're going to look to be pushing out grades from gradebook into the report card, eliminating even more steps for teachers.
That was a lot, I know, but we're really excited about it. The last video goes into more detail. She mentioned online assessments. The key here is that we're very excited that the teachers were thankful to have this program. Anytime we've mentioned collecting data in the past, teachers get a little on edge. Now it's becoming a little bit more streamlined. Teachers are more relaxed about it. We have a program that makes it easy and simple too. But in many ways, we are hand collecting or hand scoring things. So some of it isn't as streamlined as possible. There are aspects that are totally streamlined. For example, filling in a common grade for every student and then only changing the ones that are different is a huge time saver in elementary school. Our next video of Kayla Campa talks about the future, which is taking these assessments on devices so that we eliminate the paper pencil, we even eliminate the grade cam potentially, and then we have truly instant feedback. It was taken on an iPhone. Sorry for the quality.
My name is Kayla Campa, and I'm the instructional coach here at Sinsheimer. And something that I'm working on with my teachers here, we have coaching cycles that I know Amy Shields presented to you at a few board meetings ago. In our coaching cycles, teachers and I are working together to select goals to help collect data for student growth and achievement. And one way we found this to be really effective and to support our own knowledge of where students are and where we need to get them to is by using Illuminate.
So something that I've been working on is creating assessments. I've pulled up our fourth grade assessments here and have labeled them by different standards that are aligned with our standards on the report card. One assessment that our fourth grade students took was recently on language standard 6. When I click on it, you can see here that the student's overall performance is indicated by a performance band that you can see meets expectations, exceeds expectations, approaches, or needs more time. This aligns with our report card that teachers are currently using. If I scroll down, you can see a little bit more information about questions that are lowest performing, and it gives the teacher a little bit more information about where they need to focus on with their students. So this standard in language was an assessment taken by students in our fourth grade classroom, and the reason we chose this standard was based on our coaching cycle on language. So if I scroll down here, this is a first grade assessment that was taken on the iPad for reading information. If I click on it, now I can immediately see that this student meets expectations for reading informational standard 2, which is a main idea in details. And I wanted to show you an example of what an assessment might look like. So this is a printout of what they might read on the computer, and then they answer some different questions about it. In kindergarten, I had some students take an assessment, and they did it on the iPad, and they saw different questions with pictures of things that rhymed with words I was saying. So it can look a lot different in how the students and teachers administer the assessments and how the students take the assessments, but ultimately, it helps our teachers be more informed formatively of how students are doing related to specific standards. It helps us set goals so we can see student progress. It helps students practice those skills and get immediate feedback and data.
All right. Kayla is a superstar. She spent, I think, most of her spring break creating those assessments for every grade level, for every standard. I know this because she's my next door neighbor. She really opened up our eyes, literally, to what Illuminate can do. Because if you make those all, we can share them across sites, which we have already started doing. You know that many of our sites have gone to a one-to-one model. And so we're really looking at a real possibility of customizing common assessments to track our student progress so that we can teach them better. Our next steps essentially just include more. We know we're going to stick with Illuminate. We know we love it. We know it can do this much, and we've only scratched the surface with this much. So we do hope to continue integrating it into the district professional development whenever possible. I just mentioned how we aim to move to online assessments. The student-centered coaching cycle is key. It's not just collecting the data. That's what we need to get past. We need to not just collect it, enter it in, and turn the program off. We need to use the data. So that's what we hope to focus on next year so that we can have data driving our instruction. I'll end with a quote that kind of summarizes what we hope to get out of Illuminate. Last slide, please. Thank you very much. Any questions?
First, let's see if there's anyone from the public here on this topic. Seeing no one, we'll come back to the board. Any questions or comments? All right.
Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you. That was very informative. Appreciate it.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thrilled.
Okay, next is item 9.04, which is approve the agreement with Cuesta College for dual enrollment classes.
Great, good evening. I'm here tonight to talk to you about dual enrollment, and Sabrina Robertson is kind enough to spend the night with us here today as well. So thanks, Sabrina. Kyle and Leslie were both willing to be here, but as you know, it's obviously a super busy time for high school principals, so they were double booked. So tonight, I just want to talk to you a little about what is dual enrollment, the benefits to our students and teachers, talk to you about what we would like to do for next year, and then down the road what we would like. This is a really exciting opportunity for our high school students. So what is dual enrollment? High school students complete a college-approved curriculum within their high school day in order to earn academic credits that they get at the high school and at Cuesta, in our case, right, at the community college. So it's a high school student sitting in their high school chair on our high school campus with our high school teacher, but that they've made an agreement and have a collaboration with a Cuesta teacher, that they are teaching Cuesta curriculum at that level of rigor, and allows the students high school and community college credit. So why consider dual enrollment? Some of the benefits are, you know, obvious, but you think about for students that it gives students during high school an exposure to a collegiate level of learning and kind of try to demystify, so to speak, the college experience. Really gives them some rigorous, challenging opportunities while in high school. You know, hopefully increase and kind of inspire kids towards some post-secondary aspirations. Accelerate the attainment of college degree, and could even be a savings for families as they are able to begin getting some college credits during high school time. Benefit to teachers is there's great collaboration. So you're looking at Cuesta teachers that teach the same or very similar type of course as our high school students, and now they can match up and begin that conversation so that they can, you know, help really improve one another. And then they are financially compensated as they have to complete some of Cuesta's qualifications. So what does this mean for students? So students go through Cuesta's registration. There's no fee as long as they're a California resident. Students stay on our high school campus, and then they're taking a college-approved curriculum through our own high school teachers. They're eligible, like I mentioned, is receive credit in both places. Of course, they need to kind of follow the community college guidelines. They have to be careful about dropping a class. You know, Fs you definitely don't want on your college transcript type of thing. And then Cuesta, you know, does have a cap of 9 units per semester. For a teacher, so our teachers must meet Cuesta's qualifications. So that seems to be the area where it does tend to limit the number of courses that we can offer in this way. Cuesta often requires a master's degree for many of the courses and has specific qualifications that our teachers need to meet. They do collaborate annually, like I mentioned, with a Cuesta teacher, and our teachers have this approved curriculum, so it includes the level of rigor of a college course. Our teachers do stay employed as our teacher. Cuesta pays the district, and then the district can give $500 of that for the teacher's hourly time in order to complete the things that are asked of them. So which courses? What we're looking at for next year is we've looked at the teachers that met Cuesta's qualifications, and I'm happy to say Avid 9, because of our Get Focused, Stay Focused curriculum that we're looking at adding into Avid 9, this allows students that take an Avid course to be able to then leave with high school and community college credit, right? So to me, that's really exciting. I mean, think about the goals and what Avid is trying to accomplish. Think about what that does for an Avid student, right? That they could already in their 9th grade year leave with some community college. And I really think it has the ability to maybe demystify some of that for them. At Slo-Hi, we did have a few other teachers that met Cuesta qualifications, so Auto 1, 2, Engine, and then also Engineering Drawing and Design 2. So that allows for you know, some additional opportunities there since the teachers met the qualifications. And all agreements are annual, so we're looking at each year just revisiting that and seeing if any additional courses could be added. So in conclusion, I feel like this is a fantastic opportunity for our students. It creates also a community partnership between San Luis Coastal and Cuesta College, allows for good collaboration between our teachers. In the future, we're looking at additional CTE courses, and AP courses may be another way, kind of those final high-end courses there may be another good way for us to add additional courses. And we do have a few MOUs that I'm looking for your approval. I would appreciate that, and then we would hand it to Cuesta's board next in order for them to have approval of that. Any questions?
Anyone from the public hear about this? Okay. Mr. Buckman and Mr. Unger.
Okay. Thanks. Hi, Kat. I went through the PowerPoint, but then I went back and looked at the actual, I guess, the actual MOU. And so there were some things that stood out for me that I need some help with. So on one of them, one of the sections, it says the community, Cuesta College will maintain the exclusive right to control and direct the instructional activities. And then there's another section that the community college shall evaluate instruction. And our teachers have worked really hard, staff development. They're, you know, right at the top of the state on where we should be with Common Core. So are they going to be teaching what they've just learned, or are they going to be evaluated by Cuesta College on Cuesta College, where Cuesta College is? We've got several others.
Right. Important to note the distinction there between they're not evaluating the teacher, but Cuesta College, since they're giving Cuesta credit, they do have to evaluate the fact that you're teaching to the level of a college level of rigor, and then also to the standards. Now, that our teachers, sure, should be expected to do that in a way that meets Common Core standards, but you also have to remember that these are often CTE courses, so that that doesn't necessarily impact, you know, SBAC or Common Core as much. But teachers, how they go about teaching those standards is a great collaboration opportunity. And just to make sure not to confuse that Cuesta is not evaluating our teachers, they're just looking to make sure the level of rigor and the standards are being met.
Okay. Then it seems like this appears in several areas, but so let me just put it, try and get it into one. We just went through a big thing in the state with ACLU and student fees, and this talks in several locations that San Luis Costa will collect fees, that Cuesta College has fees for these classes, and I'm trying to understand how that's going to work in light of all the change. We made changes to our board policies and to state law.
And as far as I understand, there's not fees as long as you're a California resident?
Yeah.
We just have to wake your legs up a little.
So as long as you are a California resident, we waive all enrollment fees. Okay. The only time fees would come into play again would be the non-resident issue. The only thing we're asking is we would collect them, but we ask students to fill out an opt-out form so that, you know, they don't have a bill. So that's it. You know, we would ask the teacher to hand that form out and collect that form.
I'm glad I could get you to stand up and get some exercise.
It's been a long
day. I apologize. There is a section that refers particularly to material fees. So is that waived as well?
There would be no material fees.
Okay. Then it says that the records will be open for review. In K-12, it's very specific about who can look at student records, and I don't know if that's different at the community college level, and which standard are we going to use?
So for the college portion, it would always be the college standard, and that would be FERPA. It's student only unless they waive the right to other people looking at records. So when students fill out a permit to enroll form, just like with any concurrent enrollment opportunity, the parent is waiving their right to access of records.
Okay, so how are we going to get that message to parents?
It's on the permit to, they have to sign a permit to enroll form for every single opportunity, and it's pretty spelled out in there that they are, that's what they're doing.
Okay. And then, just to kind of try to wrap this up, what one of the sections says is that adults, because it's a community college class, the adults basically have to be admitted to the class. We have some fairly strong restrictions on who gets fingerprinted and who doesn't. So I know that if the teachers in the classroom and not alone with the students, then the fingerprint is sort of waived. But are we going to ensure somehow that these kids are not going to be?
So dual enrollment, for Cuesta to offer any college course, it has to be open to the general public. That is Ed Code for us. That's that second piece to that MOU, which is the open campus policy.
Mm-hmm.
Cuesta has made a we have to have it open to the public. There's just no way for us to offer Cuesta classes without it. However, we've sort of made the agreement with the K-12, the high schools that are doing this, that we would do everything in our power if a public person did enroll in that class to try and find them another spot at Cuesta so that they would not be sitting in your classroom. It's also on Open Class Finder, and it's very, very clear that these classes are on high school campuses during high school day and that they would have to follow all district rules.
Okay, so and this is an extreme, I think, but if a sexual offender is allowed to take classes at Cuesta College, is that fair?
That is fair.
Okay.
However, that person, due to their own status, would not be allowed to be on your property.
Because of the state.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Lastly, this was direct out of it. It said, both parties will ensure that ancillary and supportive services are provided for students. Examples, counseling, guidance, and placement assistance. So where are we going to, are the students still going to report to their counselor? Can they go to Cuesta Counseling?
So the way we have interpreted that, and this is a statewide concern as to which comes first, there are very specific rules. Like, for instance, disabled student services is the big one that we are a little worried about. Yes, they could come to counseling. They would have access to services at the college, just like any other college student would have. But there's some things they wouldn't be eligible for because they're not full-time students, or like for DSPS, the student has to be their advocate. The student has to go through the process just like any other college student would have to.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Unger.
Thank you for asking the question about campus access, because that was something I was curious about too. Just quickly, right now when a student takes classes at Cuesta, the class grades don't count toward their GPAs, and I know we've had some people that have been upset about that in the past because that means they can't be valedictorian. How do their grades count? So are we counting that toward the student's total GPA for high school, or is that separated out like we're doing now?
Right. It's separated in a way, right? So they still have high school credit, which will be on their transcript for the high school portion of the course, and then their Cuesta transcript is a separate transcript in this case, so that the course is then held in two places.
But I'm more specifically thinking about the grades that the student actually gets, because it'll be a Cuesta class.
Right. But
so
remember that it's both.
For both Cuesta separately, but also toward their San Luis, let's say San Luis High, toward their San Luis High total GPA.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Millar.
Thank you. So the MOU we're being asked to approve is both Part A and B on the item here?
Correct.
And this MOU will cover both Morro Bay High School and San Luis Obispo High School?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? All right, we need to...
I'll move approval of the MOU.
All right. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. All right, item 9... I see, Kim, you're not going anywhere. Item 9.05, ELD, ELA, secondary assessments.
Great. Ms. Erin Kunkel-Dyle, I'll be glad to present some data information about English language arts assessments and ELD assessments at the secondary level tonight. So if I can move to the next one, Kim, thank you. So our goals are around our secondary common assessments are obviously to be Common Core and SBAC aligned, to be embedded within the curriculum. That sounds... like a goal, you've probably heard us talk a lot about that, right? But we want teachers to really buy into this and to have an assessment that they believe in, that they're wanting the data that is attached to what they're teaching and what they're doing so that it's valuable, just like what you saw in the Illuminate presentation. Keep in mind that we're still working towards a better alignment with SBAC. As you will see today, SBAC has raised the rigor on 8th and high school English language arts task. So as they raise the rigor, you will begin to see it's much different than we used to see in CST, and this will show in the percentages of students that are able to be proficient as that level of rigor really changes. Also, SBAC has released more detailed resources, which means their rubrics, the way that we're grading the English language arts, is also increased in rigor. I'll turn it over to Erin.
Good evening. So last spring was the first time that we administered a full ELA performance task to students. We also administered performance tasks that actually came from Illuminate. They're proprietary and available to all users of Illuminate for our fall assessment this year. These current assessments that we just gave students are released tasks directly from Smarter Balanced, so SVAC directly from the tests that they're taking right now in their classrooms. In a performance task, students read three or four sources on a topic. Most of them are informational in nature, so newspaper articles, things like that. It comes in two parts. So the first part, they answer three research questions about those sources. And in part two, they write a full essay. This spring task was an argument essay. So all of the grade levels wrote a full essay on different topics. So grade 7, for example, the topic was whether or not naps are generally good for people. And those sources will reflect both sides of that argument. So some saying it's really good for you, some saying, well, makes you tired afterwards. I personally could have used a 24-minute nap, which seems to be the optimal timing, according to the sources, this afternoon. And the 8th grade one was on the penny, whether or not we should keep it, if it's good for anything. And 9 through 11 was on financial literacy and whether or not a course should be required for high school students for graduation. So this year, so last spring we also had all students in 7 through 11 complete an argument performance task. So we have some comparative data for you this evening. So last spring we saw that about 49% of students were proficient on the task. And this spring, we saw about 55% of students were proficient on the task. This is really good because of that increased rigor that Kim was talking about. So we got some new resources from Smarter Balanced. They put out some resources on how evidence should be elaborated and what they're looking for and some different types of that we didn't have before. And they also added some requirements based on citations and how students need to actually cite their sources in their answers. And we also got the interim assessments, which next year we'll move into using for some of our common assessments, that have some great exemplar papers that show you exactly what each level looks like. So it really illustrated for us what those expectations were, and we found that they were a little bit more rigorous than we had previously thought. The research questions make up about a third of a student's total score on the performance task portion for SBAC, and previously we hadn't quite had down the importance of these. So last year, the questions were a little bit different. So for example, on the penny task, it asked students, list three arguments for keeping the penny, and list three arguments against keeping the penny from the sources. And they didn't have to cite which source it was from, they just had to find those ideas in the task. This year, and so on those types of questions where they still had to kind of analyze the evidence and integrate it and find their answer, we saw that about 76% most students were proficient on this. This year, they increased the rigor on these tasks. So students have to not only analyze the evidence, but they also have to evaluate it and cite information. So my example for this one, this year, they changed those pro-con questions to identify which source provides the best evidence for why we should change the how they could reduce the cost of the penny. So not only do they have to identify the correct source, so if they pick wrong one that doesn't have the best argument, they automatically don't get the points. But then they also have to find two specific details from that source and explain why that makes it the best source. So that bar kind of went from medium level of difficulty, find the pros, find the cons, to a very high level. Students did struggle with this. So now we saw about 33% of students being proficient on the research questions. So even though we gained some ground in essay, you're going to see that overall we lost a little ground in performance task overall because those two scores are combined to get their total score on the performance task. So by grade, last year is in green, and this year is in blue. So for seventh grade, the task did not change. It's the same exact task that we administered last year. And we saw that far more students were proficient. In our discussions last year with seventh grade teachers, we found that counter-argument, so acknowledging that opposing opinion, some people might say that we should keep the penny, but really, and then provide evidence. Seventh grade is the first time that they're required to have that skill, and we noticed that students struggled. And teachers this year addressed that with students and also addressed how to pull evidence and integrate it into their work, and I think that shows. For the other tasks, those research questions that shift, especially with eighth graders and ninth graders, really that rigor, we see quite a difference. Ninth grade also, last year at this time, were administered the eighth grade task. So the teachers had chosen that ninth grade is closer to eighth grade in rigor. And then this year we looked at it and said, we want to be looking forward. We want to know where they need to be going. So that ninth grade students, 22% proficient, they still have 2 years of work on that same rigor of task before they actually have to take the summative SBAC assessment. So why 22% proficient isn't what we want to see, it's realistic for a ninth grader on an 11th grade task. 10th and 11th grade students performed fairly similarly. We lost a little ground, but considering the raise in rigor, they did pretty well. Okay. And this last one on ELA Common Assessments is by student group. Overall, students were less proficient, but given the rigor, maybe could have been a little bit worse. And then SED and EL also held ground. I know, especially with EL, teachers have been focusing on getting them towards proficiency, at least out of that level one category. But we still do have an achievement gap that we need to address in secondary for common assessments. And then just next slide is ELD Common Assessments. ELD Common Assessments, we adopted a new assessment this year. It's called the Lost Links. It's aligned with Common Core and CELT, which is our ELD, our English Learner Assessment for the state of California. We gave it for the first time in the fall. It's administered on the computer. It's very good practice for the SBAC, and it has some really good questions. It's really interesting, and I shared some of those with you in the fall. So in the fall, we saw about 30% of students were proficient. And so in the spring, we saw about 33% of students were proficient, so they're making a little progress. But if we look at the domains, listening, speaking, reading, and writing, we see some real growth here, especially in writing, up 19%. So only 30% were proficient in the fall. Now 49% are proficient in writing. So I really like this new assessment for ELD because it allows us to gauge their progress over the year. They take the CELT at the beginning of the year. They took this mid-year and end of year. So it also provides us with data to make decisions for these students. So for example, if I'm an English learner in an ELD class, I'm probably a level one or a level two, sometimes level threes, and I can make a lot of progress in 1 year. And this time of year, we're making decisions about what class you go into next year based on an assessment that you took at very latest in October of this year. So we were still making decisions based on assessments from October in May. So now we have this and help us gauge kids' progress a little bit more fluidly throughout the year. And to sum it up, we'll bring Kim back.
So in summary, we think about the task and the process are obviously becoming a lot more aligned with the expectations that we find in Common Core and SBAC, especially the level of rigor that's expected. We're seeing student growth in English language development and able to monitor that progress throughout the year. We're also seeing good growth when it comes to the essay portion of the English language arts task, as there's been some consistency with that. We do need additional work and focus on closing the gap when it comes to socioeconomically disadvantaged and English language learners. Also, our goal is to keep embedding the rigorous aligned common assessments within our curriculum, just like I mentioned in the previous presentation. So are there any questions about ELA or ELD secondary assessments?
Anyone in the public wanting to address this? Seeing none, we'll come back. Any board discussion? All right. Thank you very much, Kim.
You're welcome. Thanks to Aaron, too.
And to Aaron. Yes, thank you. All right. Next, we have item 9.06, the declaration of need for fully qualified educators.
I wish I could speak about this like Eldra Avery spoke about Illuminate, let me tell you.
Come on, give it a try.
So exciting. We are talking about the declaration of need. We do this every year. So it's hard for me to get that excited about it, but she is so exciting. So this is, we file this at the state every year, and it's for teachers that don't have the CLAD or where they need emergency credentials. And really, the CLAD has become a non-issue pretty much for us, except for people from out of state that apply. So if we do accept a teacher that's from out of state, they wouldn't have a CLAD, so that would be an issue. But now their CLAD is embedded within the credentials, so it doesn't tend to be the issue that it was, say, 5-10 years ago. So this is asking for some CLADs. Those would be for the teachers that are outside of the state. And then we have, because of our Pacheco program, sometimes we find that our strongest applicants don't always have a B CLAD, but they happen to be fully bilingual, so they have to get an emergency and then pass the exam. And then special education. Sometimes we have some authorizations that we need to get a short-term staff permit. Currently, we just have one CLAD waiver for a CTE teacher. We have a B CLAD at Pacheco that where Cal Poly is now offering a new B CLAD program, so that's great. That'll be wonderful for our teachers that need that. And we have a special education limited term, a limited assignment permit that we had to issue this year in the area of orthopedically impaired. So if you have any questions.
Anyone from the public been waiting for this item? No? Mr. Unger.
Thank you. For our intern programs, we have three universities that we participate with the intern programs. I see Cal Poly isn't one of them. Can you tell me why?
I do not know that. Do you know that, Rick?
Cal Poly.
No, they don't have...
Cal Poly offers no internships whatsoever for any programs.
And these are really for those specialized credentials, so...
Anything else? All right. Do you need us to we need to do this by motion? Is that what you're waiting for, an approval?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll move approval of item 9.06.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. It was Mr. Unger and Mr. Buckman was the second.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next we have is 9.07, board retreat planning. Dr. Prater.
Yes, July 14th is the board's summer retreat, and I was hoping that we could find a subcommittee representing three members of the board that would be willing to help plan the retreat.
Okay, let's see some hands go up. Mr. Buckman. I will volunteer. And Mr. Quesenberry. Okay.
So Mr. Buckman, Mr. Quesenberry, and Mrs. Sheffer.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Isn't that Bastille Day?
Oh, it is. Yeah.
We usually have.
I would like some fine French food to be served. Yeah, sing the Le Marseillais. Yeah.
Marseillais,
whatever. Okay. My French is lacking.
Mr. Millar will look that up on Google and we'll sing it.
All right. Okay. So we'll get together at some point. Okay.
I think one of the questions in here is the date okay?
Yeah, are we confirming that date? Yes.
Yes. If that, I would.
I will go.
I'm assuming it is the 14th of July,
yes.
Based on our December
yes.
calendar. So if it doesn't work, the sooner
it's
I
too
know,
late.
The better. Yeah,
yeah, because I'm going to make my plans based on that. So
okay.
We'll speak with a bad French accent.
Okay.
Yeah. Ooh la la. All right. 9.08. Approve board member compensation for permissible absence.
Yes, I'm looking for the board to approve Mr. Buckman's absence from the last board meeting, I believe, as he was ill, and I was hoping you could approve that absence.
I'll move approval.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention by Mr. Buckman. All right, we're moving on to the action consent portion of the agenda. Item 10.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.02, disposition of surplus property. 10.03, acceptance of donations. 10.04, approve purchase orders. 10.05, approve adult education course offerings for 2015-16.
10.05.
Right. All right. I would entertain a motion for items 10.01 through 10.04.
I will move approval of items 10.01 through 10.04.
I'll second.
All right. Motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Mr. Millar, how unusual.
Thank you for acknowledging that. I just thought we should honor the fact that Sally Ames is still sitting here at the end of the night by at least bringing this item forward and having an opportunity to thank her again for the hard work she puts into a very successful adult ed program. And with that, I will move approval of item 10.05.
I'll second it.
I just want to know what insanity is. Because that's one of the courses.
It's an exercise.
I know what it is. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Just kidding.
And I'll be signing up for not an exercise class, but one of the other classes that I've taken before in the same area. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Carry on, Ms. Ames. Okay. Any advance agenda items? And reports by board members. Mr. Unger, Mr. Buckman.
I just got back from Sacramento, where I attended a lot of things, but one of the things I went to was today, and it was a meeting of the Education Coalition. And the main topic of discussion was about Proposition 98 and the money, and just to continue the Ed Coalition's message to the state not to manipulate the money's going in or out of Proposition 98.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman?
Yeah, I did get a chance to attend the memorial service for Larry Patterson, and it may have been reported last time, but it was a great mix of the education community, the faith-based community, and just the community. And, you know, I've known him. I knew him for a long time because I worked at the county office, and he and you know, I would talk, and there's so much I learned at the memorial service. He was just a very humble man. It was really nice. The second thing is, and I wish all the bus drivers were still here, after I was fairly amazed since the start of school that I have had no phone calls from parents or teachers or classified staff that I know. We have overlapping construction on Los Osos Valley Road, South Higuera, And I live on South Lake Erin and have not been able to get out of my driveway or back in without driving halfway around town. There's construction on Monterey Street, and the transportation department has, I don't know how they do it. I'd like to start riding a school bus instead of using my car. So I just want to thank them and thank Annie for the job they're doing. Our students evidently are arriving on time, and no complaints from parents or staff. So I'm absolutely amazed. It's wonderful.
Mr. Quisenberry.
I'm hoping that Dr. Eisendrath Rogers will join me on this. We had the pleasure of talking to Ivan Simon's U.S. government class today, and I'm pleased to report that the students were interested and involved. And Dr. Rogers, you want to add anything to that?
Hopefully we disproved Mark Twain's quote about board members, which I will not repeat. Yeah.
And I also have one other observation to make. I had a physical therapy session in Morro Bay, and I had a chance to go by the junior high school at, that would have been 7:57 this morning, and went through two light cycles there at the junior high street, counted 40 cars going into the high school, into the junior high, and coming out, and exactly 12 students walking or riding their bikes. Not that I want to give anybody any more work to do, but it was astounding to me that there were that many vehicles, and that was in 3 minutes that I made that count, dropping kids off at school. And we wonder why we talk about young people's obesity. Not that I'm pointing the finger. I certainly not want to do that, but it's amazing to me to see that many kids be driven to school. Would be an interesting thing to kind of put place before parents why they think they need to drive their child to the junior high. Anyway, end of comment.
Madam Chair, I had a note here and I didn't get down to it, and I apologize. Can I just a little more praise for the transportation department? I also looked at this as a fine example of the Common Core. Which says we want kids to work collaboratively, solve problems, and to communicate. So I'm thinking that we could give this as a model lesson that the transportation department's doing.
I'd like to just comment that some of us attended the board walk at Sinsheimer a week or so ago, and we were presented with a poster thanking us for the new playground, and it was signed by all the kinders at Sinsheimer. So I will leave this with Kim, but it was really nice that they're out there all the time and enjoying their new playground. So, Mrs. Roger.
Yeah, I just have I'm not sure if this is the appropriate forum for it or maybe the Measure D study session, but I see Mr. Palazzo in the audience. And I had noticed several times when I went by Cuesta College that they have signage thanking the community, you know, for supporting their bond and just sort of putting out there that those dollars are at work. I see Mr. Pinkerton saying his light's gone on.
Yeah, so we actually had a meeting today to discuss that very thing. And so the board, of course, put forward a contract last meeting for us to begin a communication plan. So we actually, Mrs. Berteau, Mr. Plaza, and myself met and talked exactly about what you're saying. So we're going to work on that.
That's terrific, because I know it takes a while to...
It's important.
...to form our ideas, to get a plan, and then get that through the DSA. And before anybody really sees construction begin... I think it's good for the community to know that we're in process. Thank you very much.
We could have like a countdown.
Yes.
This 300 days till construction. This sounds like an assignment for Mr. Robinette in the Los Osos community. The Rotary Club has an electric sign. Perhaps we could talk to Gary Dove and put something on there, at least for the Los Osos community. What do you think about that, Mr. Robinette?
I think as the president of the Los Osos Rotary Club, you should be able to get that done, Mr. Quisenberry. I'm just the treasurer.
All right. On that note, we will adjourn until Friday of this week when we have a Measure D study session from 9 to noon up in B3, and then our next regularly scheduled board meeting on June 2nd at 6 p.m. in this very room. Thank you.